Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, well, I almost didn't get to Action Radio today. I had a little technical glitch. I made the mistake of going back to my old time of 6 o'clock to schedule the show. And it probably says on Facebook. And if anybody's wondering, you know, what happened? Well, I made a mistake. It happens a lot. This is why I need a producer to kind of, you know, backstop me for any time I do something really stupid, which is every day, every show, every hour of every day, something stupid happens. Anyway, so I scheduled it for 6 by accident. And so I tuned in about half an hour ago to log in and check out the site and, you know, the stuff. And then all of a sudden I saw that my show had been running for half an hour. Like, how the hell did that happen? So I thought, well, how do I change that? To erase that episode and, you know, do a bunch of other stuff. But it seems like everything is fine now because I never logged in. I never started that one. So I just changed the time on it. And now we're starting at the proper time. Now, today's going to be a busy day. Because we have Shelby Frenette checking in here in the next, as soon as she checks in, we'll get started with Cruise and Travel. We've got at 7:30, we've got Josie Cossio at the Latino Report. 8 o'clock, we've got the new time for Dr. Peter Pryde in this National Security Report. And we have a very special guest in the third hour, and that's Emily Nunez, who is, she's, as I have in the title here, she's a veteran of the Navy and the Marines. She's a broadcaster. She has her own podcast, Hispanic radio podcast. We'll find out about that. She's a writer, researcher, editor, and she's a state legislative candidate. So we're going to talk to her as well. And so there's a lot going on, and it's a crazy time. It's a crazy time for all of us. I was watching news last night, and Jesse Waters was fondly saying that DeBrandon is basically retired and he's going back to the cave. You know, he says it's over. His administration was over. Well, quite frankly, his administration never started because he never had an administration. I know I keep saying that. I know that it just boggles the mind that no matter what we do to correct the language, they keep saying it wrong. And, you know, if you say President Biden, you're acknowledging the coup. You just are. You know, and you can't do that, you know, because that just so shows a toleration for treason. And we don't have I don't have any toleration for treason. Ain't going to happen that way. Anyway, so that's happening. Let me get back to my notes here. A bunch of us stuck on. The biggest thing, of course, Thursday night, the hearings of the January 6th Let's Stop Trump Committee, you know, the insurrection committee to stop the continuation of the coup. Remember, we said this before. We talked about this earlier also, that a coup has to be maintained and that, yesterday's lies have to be reinforced by today's lies, which will then have to be reinforced by tomorrow's lies. And so the lie committee, the committee to perpetuate the lie of the coup, is the January 6th committee. And so it's quite interesting to hear the manifestations and permutations. You've got Democrats and a couple of, you know, token transgender Democrats, you know, formerly Republicans on the panel. And that's about it. So it's the witch hunt committee, and their sole job is to try and prevent Trump from getting reelected. Ain't gonna happen. You know, it shows what bad position they're in. But I'm still worried about the Republicans. I mean, I am still not convinced that even if they win, which I think they will. I don't think there's enough vote fraud in the world to stop the GOP this time. But the problem is what they're going to do once they win, you know, with Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, you know, in charge of the House and the Senate. You know, what hope do we have? What hope do we have for legitimate legislation? What hope do we have for our legislation? I mean, our stuff's completely out there. We've got a very interesting group of stuff here in terms of the bills that we have, particularly the latest one, which is the Constitution Amendment to remove the power of Congress to borrow money. And the more I think about it, the more I realize how powerful that really is. It would stop everything. It would stop the national debt from increasing. It would force the national debt to be paid off as the bonds came due. It would eliminate inflation because inflation is based on borrowing. So if you eliminate borrowing, you basically eliminate inflation because inflation is based on increasing the money supply. So it's the printing of money to cover the borrowing. So if you stop the borrowing, you also stop the printing of money. Well, if you stop the printing of money, you know, then the money supply stays constant. Well, if the money supply stays constant with, more Americans, you know, legitimate citizens, not the folks coming across the border, but the more Americans creating more work, raw materials plus work equals finished goods equals, you know, sales equals wealth. You know, so with wealth increasing and the dollar amount staying basically the same, the dollar is going to increase in value. Well, when it increases in value, you know, you have more purchasing power. Well, when you have more purchasing power, the prices go down. When the prices go down, you get to buy more stuff. You know, it's called deflation. It's the one thing the bankers hate more than anything, because their goal is to keep making your money reduce in value. Well, it's already about, what, 3 cents from what it was in 1913? So my goal in eliminating the power of Congress to borrow money would be able to get the money back to a dollar from 3 cents. You know, so in other words, the worth of the money should reverse itself. If Congress stops borrowing, of course, then we have to get rid of the Fed. So if we stop Congress from borrowing money and then basically take out the Fed and replace it with the Treasury, which is what it's, you know, it's supposed to be, then we're going to basically reverse this downward spiral of money. The money should upvalue again. Things weren't too bad in 1913 in terms of the value of money. I mean, you know, like I say, 3 cents, you could buy today what you spend on today, you know, in 1913 dollars, you spend 3 cents on. Well, that's not bad. That means gas would be, what would gas be? And this is even with, let's have some fun here. Let's do some calculations. Hopefully, like I say, Shelby will join us soon. We'll get to cruise and travel. All right, so let me see. So inflation. So what's this? I don't have my calculator. It has an ad on it now. So let's say the price of gas is $5 a gallon, which is what it's about to be. So do you remember our prediction? Everybody remember our prediction where we said, it was my prediction actually, where I said that the threshold of revolution for gasoline is $7.50 a gallon. When it reaches, and $10 in California, because California is always wacko and totally out of it. So when gas reaches $7.50 nationally and $10 a gallon, that's when the riots start. That's when people start standing outside the congressional offices and outside the media demanding change. And we should be there probably right before the midterms. What a coincidence. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the Brandon insurrection / deep state puts down the insurrection. So if gas is $5, times 0.03. So in other words, 3 cents or three, you know, equals. This is kind of interesting. If gasoline were bought in 1913 dollars, even at $5 a gallon today, that'd be 15 cents. So a gallon of gas without the power of Congress to borrow money, without inflation, without the money supply constantly growing, without the printing of excess dollars, without everything else, if we had $1913 dollars today, your $5 a gallon gas would cost 15 cents a gallon in $1913 dollars. Isn't that fascinating? Let's have some more fun. Let's take a look at what it was under Trump. Under Trump, it was $1.85. At least it was around here. So let's go $1.85 times 3%. 3% would be 5 cents. So that's fascinating. So your $1.85 would cost you 5 cents. So in other words, price of gas has gone up by three times as much. And so that's where we are right now. That to me is interesting. You know, that can you see gasoline at 5 cents a gallon? And then it goes to the 15 cents a gallon under Brandon. Do you think anybody would care? No, you wouldn't care one bit. That's the difference between inflation and the reduction in your currency value and what it would be otherwise. So if gas went from 5 cents to 15 cents, yeah, that's three times as much, but it's 15 cents. Who cares, right? So I found that interesting just to put that in perspective. So we shall see what's going on, what's happening, and there we go. It looks like Shelby got tied up a little bit. So let me go to one of my many other stories. I always have things for this occasion. So let's talk about, my new favorite journalist, which is Emerald Robinson. And Emerald Robinson, I think she was on Newsmax. She was on other places. Anyway, so she's got a post that she's in Substack. She has something called The Right Way. So Emerald Robinson's The Right Way, as of yesterday, they had this headline, "Mysterious and Deadly Blood Clots Are Totally Normal Now." And she says, "Get ready for sudden adult death syndrome to be the media's latest thing." So this is late last night she wrote this. She says, "The corporate media want you to know that mysterious blood clots are suddenly killing young people in large numbers. But don't you dare blame the COVID vaccines." Of course, that's what it is, right? She says, "That's right. The media is now normalizing blood clots, heart attacks, strokes, and sudden death in healthy young people. Don't be surprised if your recently vaccinated friends and family suddenly collapse and die. Our corrupt media is actually going to gaslight you with this message. It's called sudden adult death syndrome. Oh, give me a break." You know, we talked about stuff like this yesterday when we had Jordan Carr on. Jordan's running for the seat in the Florida House of Representatives. She was also Air Force. She was captain, worked in Air Force intelligence, and refused to take the jab, refused to sacrifice her life and health for an experimental messenger RNA gene, reconstruction shot. And more power to her. and she's running for state representative. We had her on yesterday. We didn't really get to the issues in her campaign because her story is really interesting. So we covered a lot of that, and we're going to probably pick it up next week or the week after or sometime soon. So she'll be back. We've got Emily Nunez today, who's, again, a veteran of both the Marines and the Navy. I'm curious how that works, although the Marines are part of the Navy. And we shall see. I think the Coast Guard is, too, in wartime. So the Navy's pretty big. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, so back to Emerald Robinson. This is fascinating. And she, I guess, was too conservative for Newsmax, which isn't hard to do. I'm surprised she wasn't on One American News. But even they are losing my faith because they keep saying things like President Biden. You know, so that's you might as well say coup accepted. You know, I've accepted the coup. I've drunk the Kool-Aid. We'll call it the coup-aid. It's the new drink, coup-aid. Do you drink the coup-aid? What's that? Well, that's when you've accepted the coup. What coup? The one from the deep state that put Brandon in the White House. And in fact, one thing I want to talk to Dr. Peter Pry when he comes on at 8 o'clock is the fact that our greatest danger, our greatest national security danger right now is Joe Biden. He is far and above more dangerous than the Russians. The Chinese, I mean, they'll be dangerous too. But I'm just saying right now, because of the situation, the deep state's put a moron in the White House and stole the election from President Trump. This is the most dangerous situation we've been in probably since World War II, except at least in World War II, although we had a Democrat in the White House, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at least he was a nationalist. He believed in this country and he loved this country. Now he had kind of a screwy way of trying to fix it with socialism, which didn't work, obviously. He extended the Depression by 10 years. But the fact is, he still believed in this country and loved this country. He just had a very different way of how he thought this country should be run, you know, by socialism instead of by a republic and by the Constitution. Okay, granted that. I can argue with him because at least we both love our country. So I can argue with Roosevelt if we were both alive at the same time. But these other folks, ain't even close. All right, looks like Shelby has checked in here. And so let's play her theme, and we'll get on to Cruise and Travel.
Yeah, man. Come with Shelby to faraway places, wonderful beaches, exotic foods, meet new and fascinating people as Action Radio Cruise and Travel reporter Shelby Fennett takes you to where dreams become your reality and experiences become your best memories. Yeah, man. Here we go.
Yep, I made her line live, my line's live. We actually started the show at the right time, despite what I did initially, and who knows? It's one of those days. It's Tuesday. Good morning, Shelby.
Good morning, Greg. How's it going?
Oh, kind of crazy. Like I said, I scheduled the show at the wrong time. I had to do a very last-minute change to get us at the right time so that I actually have my full 3 hours for today's show, which is going to be quite interesting. So I got to tell you a funny story. Before we get started here, and I know we're a little abbreviated time. Well, Jim Dykes, one of our reporters here, he does the Second Amendment report on Fridays. He'd never taken a cruise before. So he finally did, and he's putting all these pictures of towel animals, and, you know, you got his feet in various places and beaches and, you know, the deck. We have more pictures of Jim's feet than I think anything else on his cruise. That and champagne bottles and things like that. So he absolutely loved it. So I was hoping that he would call in, too, so we could talk about this. I was really hoping he would have called in before he went on the cruise so you could advise him how best to do that. But one day, I want to get you two together. Or if you have a chance, if you want to surprise him, he may not be on this Friday, it might be next Friday. But anyway, if you ever want to surprise him, you know, and say, before you plan your next cruise, Jim, talk to me. That would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But he had a blast.
So was he one of the ones that didn't think he was going to like it, or was he excited?
He was both. He didn't think he was going to like it, but he was still excited to go. So he honestly didn't know. He really wasn't sure what to expect. He was like wishful thinking. I want it to be great, but I don't know, you know. And so that's why I want him to see you, because he'd be fascinating to talk to. I wish we had like a before and after, so we could have caught his conversation before he went and then come back, you know, glowing, you know, with the tan and the, you know, all the adventures and the things he did. And so it's you know, but we'll get him one day. But another convert. We're doing well.
Yeah, it's great. It's amazing, though. I mean, right now, cruising is so different because most of the ships, not all, but most of the ships are, like, half full. So as much as that is nice, I especially think for frequent cruisers because, you know, there's no lines and such, I also think for some cruisers it can be a little less fun because there's no, you know, it's kind of like doing group exercise without the group. It's just never the same. You know, there's, like, that... You're kind of missing that hobnobbing with the other guests. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I was curious, do these ships have half the crew as well if they go out with half passengers, or do they have to go with full crew regardless?
It looks to me like they have full crew.
Okay. So that's a lot of money. Yeah. But, group activities, the whole point of a group activity is to have a group. If you're in a stand-up comedy show, you know, the laughter, the contagious laughter of all the other people is amazing. And if you're dancing, you want people on the dance floor with you. You know, if you're doing yoga at 6 in the morning when the sun rises up, you want to be the only one stretching. It's no fun. So, yeah, the group is that's part of, that's why you go on a cruise and not a solo vacation. If you wanted to go sit on a mountaintop, you know, in the lotus position and say om by yourself, you could do that. But, you know, that's not why you go on a cruise.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, it kind of misses that. There's also a part of cruising, I think, which is the coolest part, to be honest with you, is that you meet people that you wouldn't normally meet, and you have time to talk, and you're in a closed environment where, you know, you
keep meeting.
Just know each other or
you
experience things
people.
Together that you normally wouldn't.
Yeah. And you keep running people, too. It's like, you know, third meeting. You know, say, oh, hey, how you doing? And then now you're friends. How much do you think the fact that people are out of their regular routine? In other words, if people met in a cafe as opposed to on a ship, you know, what are the chances of them having that same interaction? I think the cruise environment is so different and so critical because it is out of people's routine that it makes all the difference.
Yeah. No, I think it's the part of the magic. It's one of the recipes that makes it magical, whether you're falling in love or just making friendships or just enjoying your vacation. It's the fact that, you know, you definitely are in a closed environment and you're on vacation, so you're in vacation mode, and there's just no hustle and bustle, and it's all new, so everyone's kind of experiencing stuff for the first time, you know, which puts you in a different place, and, you know, the silly things that happen and the inside jokes you end up getting with other passengers, those things would not normally happen on land. And then, you know, you get to know the crew, and there's camaraderie there, too, whereas you don't really get that on land because people are just working, you know.
They're just passing through hotels and tours and things. It's very different. You know, it's like my tour environment when I was a tour guide. We had magic for, you know, 4 or 5 hours for the longer tours I was doing. And then, of course, the duck tours were shorter and the cable car tours might be a couple of hours. But it was magic. But, you know, you extend that out onto a ship and then people are constantly interacting and react and sort of, you know, interplay with each other. It's a magic environment. But I noticed, though, that when people get back to the regular life, you know, trying to recreate the experience, you know, doesn't work. People lose touch. They get back to work. They get busy. You know, they may meet sometime or talk a lot on the phone. And it's not the same thing because you need the ship. The ship is part of the experience. And I think people think it's just the meeting that's the experience, but it's not. It's the ship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's also the water. You know, there's a lot of science behind vibrations and changing your feelings. I mean, music is a vibration, and when you hear a jazz music versus when you hear hard rock, you feel differently, right? Because there's a vibration.
Yeah.
And we're 90% water, so it's like or something like 80%. I'm sorry. I don't remember the exact percentage, but we're mostly water. And I do feel that, you know, being on the sea, there's a vibrational shift and also a match because you're moving at the same vibration. You know, the ship is actually in sway to some degree, you know, so you have this other factor at work that people don't really think about, but it's really a thing. You know, you're being moved. Your vibration is being shifted together. So
now this is fascinating. Because the
really
sound travels in waves and water travels in waves.
Right.
Have they ever
compared
the two?
Well, I don't know. It's been on my mind for a long time.
Okay.
I've always been pretty affected by water and it relaxes me. Like, it's definitely, you know, a big part of my life. Water, being near water was very important to me. Just bathing, I like baths. You know, I like the whirlpool. I like to float a lot. I may not be swimming, but I just, that water sensation is very magic. And then, you know, the science behind water, like you said, there's waves, there's vibrations. And a lot we don't know. We haven't even thought to discover, you know, we're just kind of infants when it comes to science.
We're not as smart as we think we are.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, the way they do some of the genome transferring is just so archaic. I mean, they basically just high power rifle a gene into another gene to try and make a different strawberry slash kiwi. It's not really articulate science. It's just kind of smash and grab.
Well, that's what I'm finding out too. It's like Frankenstein on a smaller scale. You know, instead of creating a person with parts here from parts there.
Right. And there is some very strategic particular science, especially coming out with AI and robots and such. But I would also, you know, remind people that it's not as advanced. A lot of things are very rudimentary and we just don't understand. And we're still learning a lot. And, you know, we only came out understanding vitamins like 70 years ago. It wasn't really a thing before. So, you know, and then at that point, you got to think just what did we do there? We tried to isolate all the vitamins. We're like, oh, vitamin C seems to be good for immunity. And then they're like, okay, well, we'll just isolate vitamin C. Well, ascorbic acid isn't really, that's the cheapest and the most readily available way to get vitamin C into people. That's what the chewables are and such. But ascorbic acid, we find out, you know, years and years later is not really something that dissolves and is what we call usable, like a bioavailable, usable. It's vitamin C, but it isn't really usable. So they change it to ester C, and ester C is a different form of vitamin C. And that's just vitamin C I'm talking about. And, you know, I mean, if you could just imagine.
Well, drink some orange juice. Eat an orange or lime or a lemon, you know, the
British
Navy.
Well, so that's another interesting
You know,
thing.
Function on
so
limes. Yeah.
Yeah, when pesticides came out, they started testing the levels of vitamins, and even just particularly in the orange, by the way. And since pesticides have been readily used, now we know that the available vitamin C in an orange is something to the effect of 10 to 15 times less than what it was 50 years ago, because the ground doesn't have the right minerals. So, you know, there's just so many so many factors, and you know, we keep moving the needle, but we're not necessarily.
Well, it's increased the production, not the quality. I mean, they make more oranges, you know, through agribusinesses. But here's this interesting too. I heard this that I never drink concentrated any juice from concentrate, because what they do is they grind up the skin. Well, the skin's where all the pesticides are, because they want that last little element of juice. Yeah. Feel free to check it out. But
concentrate meant frozen. I didn't even know it meant.
No, concentrate. It means they've reconstituted. They've done something to it and added water. So in other words, they either dried it out and added water. So they've concentrated. So in other words, it's like, you know, Kool-Aid in a powder. Then you add water and it makes a drink.
Right.
Look it up. Check it out. I mean, but if I remember correctly,
interesting, because I have to say that I like overlooked that one. And there is just so many things.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, we all back up here. You know, we're one big happy family. So we're constantly backing up. But that's why I drink Tropicana. Not to plug Tropicana, although they certainly should be contributing to Action Radio after this, but they're not from concentrate. And so there's a reason it doesn't have the bitter taste that other orange juices have. Well, I won't drink other orange juice. That bitter taste comes from the skin, comes from the concentrate, comes from the pesticides, comes from all the crap that they're putting in there. And Tropicana doesn't do that. You know, so it's not made from concentrate. They can't use the skin. It just doesn't work, which is good. That's why it's more expensive too. But, you know, I'll spare the skin and the pesticides.
My reasoning for not drinking concentrate was just because it was bitter, like you said. Like, I have to be not from concentrate just because of the way it tastes. You know, an interesting fact about Tropicana and Florida oranges in general is that I can't buy a Florida orange here hardly anywhere. And the reason is because most of the Florida orange groves are contracted with Tropicana to get the orange juice out. So I just find that funny that most of the oranges I buy here in Florida are from California, not because I prefer that, just because that's all that's available.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. You know, strawberries, I try to buy Florida strawberries. They're different than California strawberries. You know, in fact, where I used to live in the Bay Area, you know, most of the produce, like the celery, strawberries, citrus, things like that, are from very close by. They're in a place called Watsonville, which is right next to Monterey. And so you've got a ton of produce there. California's a big problem. I post this. You might want to check this out, too, on the Action Radio Environmental Action page. I detail a California water supply, and they used to have, you know, floods up north and, you know, not too much rain in the south. And so they had this diversion project, this huge canal runs through California to distribute the water. And they used to, and they would get a 20-foot snowpack every year up in the Sierras. And that would run into the San Joaquin and the other river, Sacramento River. And that would then be diverted into the farmland. So you'd have the richest farmland in the world, basically, the Central Valley of California. It's got some of the best soil anywhere, and it's still good. It hasn't been completely farmed out or anything like that. But Californians and the federal government are now divert between 80% federal and 90% state water into the ocean. Well, the ocean doesn't need more water. The Pacific has plenty of water. It doesn't need more water. Okay, but the farms do. And so part of the reason that things are so expensive, and even though we have a lot of California produce, they've diverted between 80 to 90%, whether it's federal or state water, from the farms into the ocean. That to me is reckless insanity, if I can put a new term together. But
wow.
That's part of our supply problem. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go to the environmental page. It's right there. There's a woman I'd love to get on the show who's documented this very carefully. And the reason I post about California water is because California feeds so many millions of people. And you destroy that, and you destroy our citrus crop here in Florida. There's something called, and then I'm going to start working on this. We've got Emily Nunez. I might ask Emily to do that here. They're called perpetual easements. So in other words, just quickly scroll something down. What that does is that makes, say you have land that's farmland. If it's a perpetual easement, it stays farmland. So you can buy it, you can sell it, you can divide it, you can increase it, you can do whatever you want with it, as long as it stays farmland. And I think that's something we need to start doing. Even in Santa Rosa County here, we have peanut farms, cotton farms, different things like that in the northern part of Santa Rosa County. Well, if we housing develop our way out of our agriculture, you know, where are we going to get our cotton and peanuts and all the other things that are grown here? And where are you going to get your citrus from? I mean, when's the last time you saw an ad for Florida oranges? You know, in the 80s and 90s, they were all over the place. Well, where'd they go? Are they now condos in Miami? You know, what happened to those orange groves? It's a good question.
Yeah, and there's what's the other thing about California? Fukushima is still draining into that area. You know, Fukushima is the water tides go down.
Do you have any testing results on that? Because I know that when I was there, I'm not as concerned now because I'm in Florida. But when I was in California, I used to monitor that. You know, and I would check how mm-hmm. much radiation is coming from. Fukushima was affected by a tsunami, and it was a nuclear power plant on the coast, which is a really great place for a nuclear power plant. Well, they do that to get the water, and they use the water for cooling because nuclear power, if not cooled, nuclear reactors will literally melt down. That's what a meltdown is. It literally melts through the floor into the earth, and all the radiation goes with it. And so it's a horrible thing. That's what happened to Chernobyl, because Chernobyl, the Russians didn't build containment. American power plants have several feet, you know, 6 to 10 feet of concrete to contain any radiation should there be a nuclear accident. Chernobyl didn't have that. That's why that's such a disaster. Now, Fukushima had a containment. They had all the safety features, but I don't know if they had tsunami protection. So whatever happened to that reactor, the reactor leaks. It got in the ocean water, and it spread throughout the ocean, and I'm not sure what the effects are. It's very low level, but the water has made it to California, and I know the water goes that way because do you remember if there was a tsunami wave across the entire ocean? And when I was in San Francisco, we actually photographed it. Someone made a you can still YouTube with this. Someone made a YouTube of the tidal wave, the tsunami from Japan. It was about 6 inches high, and you can watch it going across San Francisco Bay. It made it through the Golden Gate and continued across San Francisco Bay and eventually stopped.
Wow.
How's that? Yeah. It's out there. The YouTube's still there. So, you know, I'm making this stuff up. But that's how connected the world is to everything else. And anybody that thinks you can't be a conservative and an environmentalist, I got another thing to tell you. Because I'm extremely environmentally concerned, but I also deal with real science, not made up, you know, stuff. And so this is very real, that the oceans are connected, that there's too much plastic in the water, that it should be immediately biodegradable within days of exposure to sunlight. You know, I mean, there's certain things that they can do, but they don't. And especially China and India, which are the greatest releasers of plastic pollution in the oceans. And it's really disgusting. Well, I'm on my soapbox today, apparently. So, yeah. Do you ever see plastic on the cruises? Do you ever see it out in the open ocean?
Well, no, I have not, but I have seen the documentaries where, you know, the plastic in the ocean is just, there's more plastic than fish or something. It's just horrible. I find it, so when you're in the ocean, we have an environmental officer now, since the early 2000s, and we all have to take a training that explains sort of like what gray water is and
what's gray water?
Gray water is the water that is basically rinsed from the shower and from what goes down the sinks, and it's treated and recycled into drinking water.
Oh, really?
Or cooling water.
Oh,
yeah.
New.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we have, I mean, there's recycled water. They have, like, water purification systems on board that can change bad water into drinking water. And
wait, how about desalination? Why don't they take ocean water and just desalinate it?
Right, they do that, too. Yeah, they absolutely do that as well.
Yeah.
But it's pretty fascinating what it can do with the filtration systems. But ultimately, I think the training is more about educating you not to pollute into the ocean, and we are not allowed to throw anything overboard, not a piece of gum,
mm-hmm.
nothing.
Yep.
So it's always really sad for me to hear that, you know, people are dumping, like, dump things in the ocean. Like, it's a thing,
mm-hmm.
like you're allowed to or something. It's absolutely horrible. It's, you know, it's someplace that we need the sustainable water, like polluting the water purposefully. Paint. I mean, people would just dump paint in the water. It's just horrible.
Yeah,
but,
oil,
you know,
change in the storm
I
drains, that kind of thing. You can't do that. You just cannot
right,
do stuff like
right.
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's really sad. It really is. Anyway, I love the ocean, and I get so sad to see so much dead coral reef, and, you know, it just doesn't seem like it's a priority. And I also feel like there's, people aren't trying to, they're trying to go too far, too fast. Like it's kind of like you have one side that's trying to just live off cardboard alone, which isn't possible anymore. And, you know, we need plastics. We plastic is an amazing invention, but we also don't need to have plastic or styrofoam plates, you know, like that doesn't need to be happening. But it, most
mm-hmm.
of the time, I think it's not really a personal level. It's more of a manufacturing level. You know, it's like people get on their little journeys of trying to, you know, use recyclables and only buy American made. But ultimately, it really needs to come from the manufacturers, because those are the worst culprits. So, you know, you can not use your plastic fork, but ultimately the person that's, you know, making a million plastic forks is the biggest problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like we are coming up with solutions that are meant for the greater good. It's just kind of just making people aware and making their little lives different. Like, make sure you turn off the faucet in between brushing your teeth, which I do. But, like, let's be honest, that the most waste of water has nothing to do with everybody brushing their teeth. It's much
nope.
more of on a manufacturer level. And, like, that's not being talked about. Instead, they're talking to the people like, you need to do your part. Well, actually, what we need to do is have the industries do their part. Like, it's not about us, really. It's about the bigger picture, the manufacturing plants and how they're working their units. And that just doesn't seem to be spoken about hardly at all, because Monsanto shuts everybody up. And it's sad. It's
not
really
on this
sad.
Show. You know, we
no,
talk about things like
but
that.
But I would say
know.
The majority of the people, you know, they all they have this mindset, like, do your part. And if you're eating off plastic, you're a bad person. And it's like, man, this is nothing. Like, you got to talk about who's doing the producing. Like, okay, Monsanto was in a plant back where I live in Massachusetts. And we didn't know anything about anything back then. but I do remember, like, when we would go anywhere near a 5-10 mile radius of the place, my eyes would burn. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't understand how people could live there. I was like, I would hold my breath for, you know, the five, as how many times I could through the 5 minutes that we had to drive through. And I didn't even know what the word toxic meant. I didn't know what that word was. I was so young, but I knew that it was poison because it was making me gag. And that was in the air, and you could see stacks of smoke. I mean, it's like, really, you know, every bad manufacturing plant that you see on a documentary, it was like that. And my mom worked there for a while. And I really remember asking, I'm like, I can't understand how you can go there and breathe. And she's like, well, they have air filtration. You get used to it. But no talk of how poisonous it is. And then no talk at all. They made styrofoam at the time.
Yeah. We need to, I need to hold you up just because I got Josie on the line. We're a little limited on time. But if you want to come back sometime and talk for an hour about environmental stuff, we should do that because I'm with you on that. There's so much that, there's so much that can be done. You can do through taxes, through incentives, through antitrust, through breaking up these companies, to having severe penalties and fines for abusing the environment and great tax incentives for helping out. You can take all those plastic straws, you know, grind them down to little tiny bits and recycle them into all kinds of things. I think they make toilet paper and other products from recycled plastic. Okay. So there are ways to do this. So there's nothing wrong. I mean, paper straws don't work. They just don't. But that doesn't mean you have to throw out your plastic straw, your plastic shopping bag. All those things can be recycled. You know, and so we can definitely do more with that, but you want to do it with a market economy. In other words, you have the incentives to do it because people always work better with incentives and punishments. Let me start Josie's thing. Well, actually, let me get your contact information just in case or when you have to go.
So
go ahead.
Definitely keep following me because we're still in the running for being on the reality show as the cruise director for the Real Love Boat. And you can find me on Facebook, Shelby Frenette or ShelbyLive.com. And I'm looking forward to having some good news for you next week. I'm Shelby. You're fabulous. Bye-bye, guys.
All right. See you later. And we'll do that environmental thing. I'll talk to you later about that. That would be fascinating. She started off as a poor child in Nicaragua, living under communism. And now she is a prosperous small businesswoman with a great family, living the dream as an American citizen. Josie Coffey knows all about both worlds, communism and freedom. She knows where your dreams can come alive and where they can die very quickly. And so her report is as much from experience as knowledge, and her passion and crusade are very real. With connections all over Central and South America, Josie brings you the world south of the U.S. border from personal experience, living, not just reporting, what's happening. And now, the Latina Report with Josie Coffey. Good morning. Buenos dias, chica.
Good morning. Good morning. Buenos dias. Dobre utra.
Dobre utra. Yeah.
Hey.
So what's happening?
I'm a little bit out of the weather.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm almost over.
Okay, right?
It happens. I get a lot of sick people at the store. What do you expect, you know?
You work in a medical environment. Of course you do. You know,
I know.
See, you must have extra antioxidants, extra vitamin C, extra immunity boosters. Honestly, because I don't see that many people. You know, when I was a tour guide, I had the best immune system in the world because I was with people from literally all over the world every day. It was fascinating.
I don't take vitamins at all.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, I really don't either much now. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've sort of let the quercetin go and the vitamin C, and I get plenty of vitamin D. I'm bike riding all the time now on the Blackwater Trail.
Yeah.
So I can be found. Do you bike ride?
I do eat a lot of fruits, you know.
Okay.
I do eat a lot of fruits. I'm a maniac when it comes to a huge tray of fruits for me alone, you know. So,
yeah. Well, that's your flavonoids, your vitamins, minerals, antioxidants,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff's in fruit. There's just a lot of sugar, though, so you got to burn it off. But you're a Zumba person, so, you know, I don't worry about you.
Yeah, and I barely don't eat fast food, so I do a lot of cooking and lots of vegetables. Last night I prepared a huge pot of beef soup, you know, since I bought the two cows, you know, so I got plenty of beef.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Josie's
a
great cook, by the way, folks. So if we all going to meet at Josie's house, my whole audience, you know, from Azerbaijan Venezuela listens now. Did I tell you? We have Venezuelan listeners.
Oh,
they
Venezuela?
Showed up on the map. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, they're on the world map,
good,
so yeah. Still waiting for Ukraine. Nobody in Ukraine yet, but
let me just say quickly, buenos días a todos los amigos en Venezuela ahorita que están escuchándonos. I said good morning to all the people in Venezuela.
Well, I got that part. I don't know what else you said, but yeah. Well, it's interesting. We actually have we've lost some of the South American countries. We don't have Chile or Argentina anymore, but we still have Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and now Venezuela. But a lot of Central America. You've got Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, and Costa Rica all listen to Action Radio. I think a lot of it's
Costa
because of
Rica.
Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get my pronunciation.
Costa Rica.
Yeah. Not bad for a white guy.
Yeah, I have a nephew that lives in Costa Rica.
Okay.
And
that's probably who's listening.
And, So 12,000 illegals are heading toward the border.
I was just going to say
they're
caravans.
Arriving pretty soon.
Yeah. Why do they call them caravans? Mm-hmm. We need a better name for them. How about invaders? How about
invaders,
deadbeats?
Criminals.
Deadbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's another deadbeat massing on our border. Yeah.
They're invading our country, literally. This is unconstitutional that this government is doing this to us. And the milk that they took away from the American people, they send it to the border. They showed pictures yesterday in some of the channels I was watching. They have tons and tons of milk, Greg, at the border, ready for that, all the illegals to arrive.
Is that the main part of the shortage, do you think? Or do you think there would have been a shortage anyway? It just, stole the supplies for their illegals. Was there going to be a shortage anyway, regardless of the illegals?
No, this was planned for the illegals. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well organized. This government is corrupt. It's sad.
Well, what do they think they're doing? Because, unless they have a massive, well, they probably do have massive vote fraud planned for the fall, but how much vote fraud is it going to take to get around the American people that hate them right now? Nobody likes the deep state. I was joking around. What are Brandon's employees going to do when his popularity falls below zero? I meant that as a joke, but that's where they're going. Even the Democrats don't like this because they buy gasoline too.
The numbers are falling and people disliking this clown, but there's a lot of stuff we don't understand. I just heard a couple nights ago, I don't know if you ever heard of David Strait, the last name.
I've heard the name. I don't know much about him though.
I think I sent you a video, but I don't know.
You did.
So many videos from so many people. Yeah.
Oh, I know, and I'll get to you. How many videos I get a day? I probably get 50 videos a day, at least.
I've been listening for hours since I've been home for 2 days, at home. Mm-hmm. I've been listening for hours, and this guy, I learned so much from him. Mm. And he's the one that claims that that he was with JFK Jr. and Donald Trump, and they landed the helicopter, Don Jr.'s helicopter, on top of the Mount Rush. George Washington's head, because that's what they wanted to do July 2nd of last year. And he was in the helicopter with them.
Is there a landing spot up there for that? I mean, it might be. I mean, this flat land behind Mount Rushmore.
Oh,
there's a bunch of flat land because that's where they staged all the equipment that they used to carve out Mount Rushmore. Okay.
And he also mentioned, Donald Trump's photographer, Gene Hall, which he's his photographer, which I met him in person, actually, in Dallas. Mm-hmm. He also mentioned him, that he took some pictures of that walk. He's also mentioning a lot of stuff, that we can be free, and how you do your write your laws and all that. Man, let me tell you, Greg, when you listen to some of this video, you're going to say, wow, that sounds like me. All the stuff that we want to speak free.
I just want to hear somebody that sounds like me. Great.
This guy is awesome.
Well, maybe we should join forces, Let me explore the JFK thing, because I know you mentioned it at the end of one of our panel discussions. And the only problem with saying something like that is we don't have time to really analyze it. And so it's tough to do. But Let's assume that, in fact, I remember, I got called by Ken Hamblin when he was on the air, the Black Avenger, because he reviewed my book on the air. We talked about it. He's a fellow pilot. We had a great chat. So when John Kennedy, we think crashed off Nantucket in his Cherokee.
'99.
Whatever that plane, I forgot what it was. It was a sixth place. Saratoga, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Anyway. The plane did crash. They did pull a wreckage out. So something happened. But it wasn't only on board. It was his wife and I think his niece or someone else is on board. There was three people. If he's alive, that probably means they're alive too. And where are they? Because
they're
you look
alive.
At that plane.
Yeah.
Okay. So why do this? Why, what's the motivation?
Because of everything that is going to come on.
Okay.
Everything. And this guy, he was working with Trump, this David Strait. He gives seminar. He's trying to teach Americans how to be free from this fake, not just Biden, but the government, our government. It is amazing. This whole thing that he explained.
Resistance is the way to
including
be free.
We don't need driver's license. We don't need marriage licenses. We don't need anything. We're Americans. Mm-hmm. We're free, and we're not free. Even with mortgages, and he goes on and on and on. And he was poisoned at the same time that Melania was poisoned. Remember, Melania was rushed to the hospital, was it a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
Melania was rushed to the hospital. They poisoned her, the deep state, together with him. And this guy's lucky to made it out, too.
What they poisoned him with?
They both got poisoned.
Do you know what it was? Do you know what it was?
I was falling asleep watching the video, and sometimes it's hard to back it up because it takes you
well,
to the beginning.
The reason I ask is because in the back of my mind, I think that, you know, if we get as big as I think we're going to get, with enough people start writing laws, and we will, okay?
You will.
Now, what are the personal consequences for me especially, but for anybody associated with this show? There's going to be a cost. They're going to come after us. You know, and I don't want to be poisoned. You know, I don't want to have to go through that. I don't want to have to, you know, wear a vest everywhere.
No, you're
I go.
Not
going to
be poisoned.
You know, but well, I hope not. But I'm just saying, you know, and I think that this is why I say every once in a while, as I say again, if you hear about a suicide, you know, with me involved, it ain't a suicide because I'm loving my life. I am having the time of my life.
Yeah.
And so in fact, Judy McLeod, who does the Canada Free Press, she said, you know, anybody who's an investigative journalist or an activist of any kind needs to make regular announcements like this, so it's on the record in case anybody wants to go back and check. Now, did you hear about the latest Clinton assassination? One of his advisors, you know, died of a gunshot wound and hanging. You know, that's a neat trick.
Yeah.
So they hang themselves and then shoot themselves in the chest with a shotgun, or do they shoot themselves with the chest and a shotgun and then hang themselves? Okay, so which came first? Or did they do it at the same time? Did they jump off the whatever it was, and as they were hanging themselves, blast the shotgun? I mean, this is some Gateway Pundit. You know, they had the articles on our special investigations page. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff's still going on.
Well, Greg, corruption has been so dark for so many years, and it's over. There's not going to be no more corruption like this. Our money's going to change. This gentleman was saying that the money's ready to go. It's in Texas waiting.
Go to what?
I don't know. He didn't say exactly because he didn't want to tell everything. But he said there's a 747 plane that they flew to Texas and it's waiting in a special warehouse, very protected, ready to go when Donald Trump returns. There's not going to be an election. All this is a hoax. Just giving time for Donald Trump to finish whatever he's going to finish.
Well, he's still the president. You know, he could be put in any time.
He is the president.
I know, and I agree with you. No, but I've said this many times that the geldings, you know, the deep state, they already know he won 316 to 222. They already know that the battleground states, the state representatives, the state legislatures have control, and they put forward Trump electors, and the governors put forward Brandon electors, and Mike Pence, the traitor, took the Brandon electors, the fraudulent Brandon electors, and counted those instead of the legal Trump electors. That's why Brandon's in the White House, because he was installed illegally by miscounting the electors, and we all know that. Okay, but given that, I mean, Trump could walk back any time.
But
so here's a question, though. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Ask me a question.
Okay, so here's the key to this that I think that we've talked about a couple of times, but I don't know if it's right in the forefront of your mind. There is a clause in the Constitution, this is the 22nd Amendment, that says that if you serve less than 2 years, that doesn't count towards your term. So in other words, if Trump takes his term back, this one, January 21st of 2023, by the time of January 20th, 2024, oh, no, it'll be 2023, by January 20th of 2025, he'll be eligible for a full term because he will serve less than 2 years in this term. So technically, let me get this out because this is kind of interesting. I think they know that. I don't think this is why Trump isn't back now. Because he knows this. If he comes on the show, I'll ask him about it. Just because I'm me, all right? But, let me see if I can find this here. Because I'm a smart guy too. Oh, here we go.
I don't know what's going on, and they're not telling us right now. But Donald Trump is a president right now as we speak.
Oh, he is.
Here in America.
Well, here's the thing too. Everything that Brandon does is ill. Is
no,
invalid.
No. But
what?
But I know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
He never left his position, never. And he has made JFK Jr. his vice president and got rid of Pence.
Unless you get, well, of course, you got to get rid of Pence. Is running against him. Pence is the new John McCain, you know. Pence is in that fine tradition of John McCain and Mitt Romney and the other leftists, the other transgender Democrats. Yeah. Well, let me read the 22nd Amendment. Yeah. Tell me what you think of this. It says, Section 1, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, okay, and no person who has – here's the key part – no person who has held the office of president or acted as president, it's kind of funny, speaking of acting as president, for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of president more than once. Okay? So if he's less than 2 years, if he's less than 2 years, it doesn't count towards the two terms. So all Trump has to do is come in January 21st of next year and finish Brandon's occupation of the White House, run in 2024, start a full new term in 2025, January 20th and 25. And if he starts January 21st, 2023 or later, it's less than 2 years and he can run again for a full term. Mm-hmm. That's the 22nd Amendment. That's
maybe
what nobody's
you're
talking
right
about.
About that.
I just read it. Of course I'm right.
Yeah,
but think about that. So if you have a question, read the 22nd Amendment. That means Trump can – but see, this is why he can't come back today. And I've known this for, you know, since the insurrection of the Democrats. You know, but he can't come back to – this is another reason, you know, he should be – he could come back now legally. But if he came back now, he'd only get the remainder of this term. He wouldn't get the next one. He knows, because he's not stupid, but he's a guy. He knows that if he comes back January 21st of 2023 or later, he can still run in 2024 for a full term.
Bottom line, this guy knows everything because he was working side by side with Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
He knows everything. He helped Donald Trump rescue 135,000 kids, and they're still arresting people. And he was telling us in the
video.
Are they? Nancy, they rescued 135,000 children. And Nancy Pelosi is on the list of a pedophile trafficker.
I don't believe that. Well, here's a question for you, too. Yeah. So I posted this a couple of days ago that this obsession that the Democrats have with young boys and girls to force them into the same bathroom, that to me is pedophilia. You know, you're sexualizing, you're doing a sexual attack on very young children, forcing them into the same bathroom, challenging everything they already know, even at their young age of 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever it is. The boys know their boys, the girls know their girls.
And the girls, the girls.
And girls go to the girls' room and boys go to the boys' room. That's the way it is, okay?
And
the sexualizing,
and the
sexual assault on these kids, I think is pedophilia.
Yeah. It's like you just said. This is sexual assault on our children. And parents are so stupid, they continue allowing their kids to go to public school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I said before, the best thing was this stupid COVID. The kids were at home doing schooling at home, and 1.2 million children are not back in public school because the parents opened their eyes what was happening in the schools. And this guy, let me tell you, this guy is amazing. I'm going to try to get a hold of him. He teaches seminars. He's going across the country teaching seminars because he wants everybody to be free like he's free right now. He doesn't do a lot of stuff that the government tells you what to do. And I think, I don't know if you ever heard that Donald Trump, he's a president, not for the corporation, but I'm not too familiar with all this yet. I was trying to listen to the video.
Well, we can do a show on it. We can look into it. Well, let me look at the video now because now you got
like
me interested.
I would like to invite him in the show. Oh, my
God. Let's do it.
That would be awesome.
Well, let's get a separate hour. I don't want him on for half an hour. We want to have him for a full hour.
Oh, so no. You haven't done any more than that.
Well, then we'll do a series of shows. I don't care. I'm the boss.
And,
I can do anything I want.
So he was telling us about all the stuff that is going on in Russia is well organized. I mean, in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. The child trafficking is well organized. A lot of the lawyers, a lot of the priests, a lot of the big head corporate, head honcho people are all in the child trafficking. It is horrible what is happening.
Problem?
But he says,
It's like the royalty of England, you know, they're all, you know, wacko, and they did things with children, and, you know, this is way back, you know, several hundred years ago. But something about power, it gets an obsession with children. You know, look at Michael Jackson, you know, as much as he was the greatest pop star of his time, you know, he had some problems with young kids. I don't care what they call it, Neverland, the whole bit, you know, but the people in power, they get this obsession with children. And I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you something totally different. You mentioned driver's license.
But on Michael
licenses.
Jackson?
Yeah. Go ahead.
On Michael Jackson, I think it was Mariah Carey's husband that created this whole child accusations against Michael Jackson, because Michael Jackson owned at the time half of Sony Record, and he wanted it all. And every time Mariah Carey got abused, she used to run to Michael Jackson complaining that her husband was evil. So Michael Jackson was speaking in front of an audience saying, we need to put away these evil people. So instead, they wanted to put away Michael Jackson.
Well, see, that's good to know. I didn't know that. I just heard that he had a bunch of kids at a place called Never Neverland. And,
I don't think he abused all those kids. No.
There's nothing wrong with helping kids. Listen, if he's got a summer camp and he's helping kids and he's, you know, a motivator of young kids, that's great.
Yeah.
Don't have a problem. But
I think Michael Jackson was framed Donald Trump, Herman Cain, the other judge from
Roy
what's Moore.
His name down? Roy Moore, even Matt Gaetz, you know, and Jim Jordan. I call it the Democrat obligatory sex scandal. Remember we were joking about that? They're going to do one on me one day. He said, with farm animals.
I know.
That was hysterical. I didn't say it. Bianchi said it. But it's true. They always have – they always pick on the sex thing because that's what they do. Mm-hmm. Democrats are obsessed with sex. And weird sex.
And the thing is, they're so stupid. They continue using the same idea over and
over. Works.
And people buy it.
Yeah. Well, then who's stupid then? The people that are, you know, it's like the whole gun debate, you know, the seizure of gun rights. Now I'm going to put out a press release. I've got a pretty decent argument. I just want to make it as short as possible and direct as possible. But I'm going to give to all of our GOP geldings and media folks that are listening. In fact, I'll talk to Emily Nunez in the third hour about this. But, The argument against what the gun laws are is very simple. They've confused use with keeping and bearing. You know, the use of firearms is statutory. Keeping and bearing firearms is constitutional. Well, the Constitution trumps, if you'll excuse the expression, trumps statutory law every time. Therefore, any statutory law they propose that affects in any way your ability to own and carry firearms or keep and bear is automatically unconstitutional on its face, simply because statutory law can't stand up to constitutional law. The Constitution is supreme, pure and simple. And nobody's making that argument that the left, you know, blurs the distinction between use and owning and carrying. And that's the problem. You know, they do the same thing with what they call immigrants, migrants. They're not migrants. They're invaders.
Right.
You're illegal aliens.
They're criminals.
There's nothing legal. There's,
I call
they're
them
criminals.
Criminals.
Yeah. But you got to call them that because language is everything. So the way that you fight the Marxist left is to use correct language, despite what they say. But I want to talk about driver's license for the next couple of minutes because this is really interesting. I have done shows on this, that the driver's license is unconstitutional. The state cannot license you for a right that you have. The Supreme Court has even described the right to travel. And I would say that that a right to travel is an inherent right, even though it's not enumerated in the Constitution, because I don't think they thought about it. But that's something we may want to look into as an enumerated right. But even if not, you absolutely have a right to travel. The state has no business licensing you to drive a car. Okay. Now, does that mean they can't enforce speed restrictions? Absolutely. They pull you over. Okay. I mean, have a bill of sale in your car. You want to prove it's your car? Carry a bill of sale. You know, there's a lot of things you can do. I mean, how do they enforce laws against anything else? You know, how do they enforce you pick something? You know, if your lawnmower is too loud, do you have to register your lawnmower? Do you need a lawnmower license? No. They come to your house and say your lawnmower is too loud. You're disturbing the peace. Okay. Did they need to, did you need to have a license for them to do that? No. So all the traffic laws we have now could be enforced just as easily. Okay. Without a driver's license. There's no need for the state to license you. Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, I'm a firm believer in making a change. So from my perspective, now marriage license is a different thing. I think marriage licenses are so you get in family court for your divorce, but that's another story.
Yeah.
We'll save that for another. I've got Dr. Pry on the line right now, but the driver's license, think about that for a second. The state never had a reason, and they say that driving is a privilege. Really? You try and get around society without driving,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless you're in, you know, Manhattan,
yeah.
you know, where you can't, there's no space for a car anyway. But even then, you still have a right to travel. And if you have a right to travel, you have a right to determine how you travel. We put that in the Australian Bill of Rights. You have a right to your choice of energy. Go ahead.
All the illegals are getting driver's license in New York City. You know, it's like, here you go.
Yeah.
So
oh, yeah, that's so they can vote.
It's corrupt.
That has nothing to do with driving.
We're
going to
change all this corruption. Yeah. All right, Greg.
Yeah.
You have a blessed day, okay?
Okay. And if you want to call back here at hour, feel free. We got a guest that you might be
okay,
interested
ciao.
In. Okay, all right. Take
bye.
Care.
God bless you.
God bless
bye
you,
bye.
Too. All right. Let's get to Dr. Pry, talk national security. And I'm going to ask Dr. Pry what I think the biggest danger to national security is, which is Brandon and his continued decline, which is obvious to everybody. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit and then whatever else Dr. Pry wants to talk about. What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Yeah, it's been a while, sir. Good morning. How you doing?
Every day that isn't a nuclear war is a good day. So
I should make that the title of your report. You know, we'll have like a little sunshiny picture, and we'll have like a bluebird in the tree. And no, you're right, though. I mean, I'm joking about this, but it's very true that every day without a nuclear war is a great day. So I'm with you on that.
Now, I saw your message that you had a candidate for the Florida House.
Uh-huh.
She's
not on yet. No,
okay.
She won't be able to call in. But if you want to leave a message that I can write down and she can check on the podcast, any advice for somebody going to the Florida House, feel free.
I'd like to talk about that a little bit first, about the EMP threat, cyber threat to the Florida grid, and how important it would be for her. I sent you probably didn't get to see it because you've been doing the show, mm-hmm. but I sent you the draft executive order to protect the EMP grid that I wrote for Governor DeSantis's office, that could easily be translated. She should consider job one. If she gets elected, I would recommend that she take that executive order and turn it into a bill to protect the Florida electric grid from EMP and cyber warfare. I think people are forgetting that Florida was singled out last April. The first time when we thought that the Russians were going to invade Ukraine, I mean April of 2021, not April of 2022,
mm-hmm.
but when the administration thought that the Russians were on the verge of invading Ukraine at that time, and maybe they were, and changed their minds and waited, they threatened that if the United States interfered in Ukraine, you know, they could shut down our electric grid. And they might use Florida as an example to demonstrate their cyber warfare power to do that. They used as
why
an example
us?
Blacking out part of New York City. They specifically mentioned Harlem. They said, well, or we could do a whole state and we could take out Florida. Or they could do the whole country. So this is, and as, you know, and as Russia struggles, as the Ukraine war drags on, and as we get more and more deeply involved in helping them, maybe mm-hmm. they'll deliver on that threat. You know, when Florida is clearly in the crosshairs, you know, the Kremlin specifically mentioned them. So it's really urgent that high priority be given to protecting the Florida grid from all hazards, but especially from cyber and EMP attack. So that's the first thing I wanted to mention.
No, I just
want to
comment on that real quickly, because she is former Marine Navy person. I'm not sure her capacity there. I'm going to find out. But if it was intelligence or any kind of technical or any kind of computer cyber connection, she probably knows about this already. But I'll ask her in the next hour.
Right. And you can so please do pass on to her what I emailed to you this morning, which is that draft EMP executive order. And
yeah,
maybe
I have
you could coordinate it with Governor DeSantis.
Yeah.
You know, the ideal thing would be for the governor to pass an executive order and for the legislature at the same time to pass a bill, you know, for the same thing. You know, if there were efforts to obstruct the executive order by the utilities and their lobbyists, you know, the bill could outflank all of that, and it would provide, justification from the people's house to say, yeah, the people want this done, and it would make it more certain that the Florida grid would get protected and that the utilities, you know, wouldn't be able to derail it the way they so often do by using their lobbying efforts, you know, against either one. It would make it harder for them to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to talk about today, and maybe this will end up taking up the balance of our time, but I want to talk about the Russian nuclear command and control system. You know, and that may seem like an esoteric topic, but I've noticed with some annoyance, I mean, this was one of my specialties when I worked in the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And and I can talk about this because I wrote a book that was approved for publication by the CIA. I was still working for the agency when I did, on a series of nuclear war scares. And the book got into some detail about how what we know about Russian command and control systems and how their systems work. The agency gave me permission to publish that book, and so I can talk about these things at the unclassified level. And I've noticed that there are some Johnny-come-latelys who are, for example, there was an article published on the Russian Cheget yesterday, which is the Russian equivalent of the nuclear football, the president's football. It's the briefcase that always follows Putin around, just like Biden is always followed around by a briefcase that would enable them to launch the nuclear forces. And people who are representing, or I should say misrepresenting themselves, there are a lot of people, you know, these journalists, they'll read a couple of books. And as a matter of fact, my book was mentioned in this article on the Cheget. You know, so they obviously didn't read the whole book. You know, they read parts of it, and that I found particularly annoying. To try to make the case, they are trying to make the case, the people who are basically supporting the Ukraine war, one of the things they're trying to tell people is that there's more than one man in the loop, that Putin can't launch the nuclear forces by himself. I think this started with Lindsey Graham, when Graham, to justify U.S. deeper, more aggressive involvement in the Ukraine war, when he was asked, well, couldn't that possibly result in a nuclear war with Russia? Graham's answer was that Putin's people would shoot him rather than let him push the button, and that Putin couldn't execute the forces himself. And both of those statements are totally untrue and irresponsible.
Wow.
And the article I read yesterday on the Cheget and how it operates is also untrue and irresponsible, basically, because both of them say, that Putin can't execute the forces. He can't launch the forces, you know, by himself. And in one sense, that's true, because just like with President Biden, you know, if he were to push the button, as it were, on on the U.S. nuclear football, you know, there are people down in the chain of command. The orders are going to go to a communication system in the Pentagon, and that's going to be conveyed to our ICBMs and our ballistic missile submarines. And so there are people in the loop, you know, who are helping the president execute his orders.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that that these other people are making any kind of a decision, you know, or would have an independent ability to stop the president, you know, by that's legal anyway. And so it makes the assumption
that's my concern, though,
that, you know, that people are going to disobey orders and not. And that may be true. It's truer for Biden than it is for Putin, because Biden is so obviously disrespected, even by the House Democrats. You know, you may recall that under President Trump, the Democrats were calling for President Trump to be to take away his authority as commander in chief to launch our nuclear forces, because they hated President Trump and he couldn't be trusted. Well, you know, they didn't stop saying that when Biden got elected. The Democrats in the House and Senate, part of what they want to do in the nuclear posture review is change the way our command and control system works so that the president can't launch those forces in an emergency, that he's got to consult with the House or something like that.
And there's how long does it take a missile
like
to get here?
Happened on the Russian side.
Hypersonic missiles are what,
only on
minutes?
Our side. Only on our side has there been this kind of discontent from the president's own political party, in this case, from Joe Biden. His radical Democrat supporters don't want him in charge of the button. But the reality is that right now, today, the way our command and control system is structured, you know, if President Biden ordered our forces to execute, to launch, he himself, as commander-in-chief, all by himself, he can do that. He could make all those forces launch, or he could launch part of them, or he could launch one missile. He could do all by himself, you know. Now, there are people, obviously, in the machine, in that chain of command, that have to obey his orders and push the buttons and send the communication systems and the unlocking codes and things like that, you know. But to assume that that isn't going to happen, you know, that somebody's going to disobey him, there's no legal basis for that to happen. And it's highly, highly unlikely that would happen, you know, because these people, that's what they do. They're trained.
Well, Milley,
you know,
he might alert our counterpart in, you know, wherever.
Yeah. Well, Milley is actually not in the chain. He's not, he doesn't have any input into it. But
interesting.
You're right. But you're right that he, you know, like he said, he could deliver on a promise. He'd probably know that the president has made a decision, and then he could inform the Chinese or the Russians or whoever and betray us, you know.
Yeah.
But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is not in any kind of a technical position to stop the president from executing those forces.
Well,
and,
can you tell me, without classified information, obviously, but what exactly is in that briefcase? Is it a phone? Is it a series of buttons? Is it a code? Is there a retinal scan or some kind of positive ID? What's in there?
It's basically a communications device.
Okay.
And it has the ability to convey unlocking authorization and unlocking codes, you know, to the Pentagon, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And these would be passed on to TACAMO aircraft to communicate with the submarines and and the TACAMOs also communicate with the ICBMs and the bomber forces as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ultra high frequency and very low frequency. I mean, we've basically got a spectrum of communications, of redundant communication systems.
So it can't be jammed, right?
We pass these
it can't
orders,
be jammed.
You know, these codes, you know, to the relevant forces so that they would launch. So they're getting them not just from one source, but from multiple sources, which is another reason why, you know, the chain can't be broken by one disgruntled person, for example, that said, oh, Biden is crazy or Putin is crazy, you know, I'm not going to obey this. It would get there through other redundant means. That's what we call positive control, to absolutely ensure that, because it's the most important thing that our military would ever do, you know, is to execute those forces. And so they are, it's hardwired into that system to get those emergency action messages, which is what they're called, you know, from the football, you know, all through the Pentagon and out to our forces, and by several redundant means. And it's the same thing on the Russian side, except it's even, I don't want to say worse, you know, because...
more direct, maybe? Putin has faster access or something? Or
it's organized in such a way. People seem to derive hope from this idea that, oh, somebody's going to stop it. You know, somebody's going to be in that loop. Because in our case, we have, you know, multiple human beings in the loop, and people derive comfort from that. And one of the things that's being misrepresented is that it's the same thing on the Russian side, okay?
Uh-huh.
And the Russians do have that same thing. They've got the Cheget, okay? And superficially, it looks like the same thing. But the Russians are more paranoid than we are about being able to execute those forces. They're much more concerned about a surprise attack. Our orientation has always been that we're much more concerned about an accidental nuclear war, something happening accidentally, you know, and so we try to protect against a mistake being made. And that's why
they couldn't think it happened on purpose. I mean, that goes against their ideology, so obviously it can't be true.
Right. And that's why we have what are called permissive action links on a lot of our nuclear weapons. The codes are a form of, or the unlocking codes are a form of permissive action link. So that the missile, not only are you getting launch orders to execute a particular part or maybe the whole PSYOP, the single integrated operational plan, you know, which is broken down into subsets so that you could launch just one missile, or you could launch all the missiles, or so any subset in between. Okay, so those are that's executing the nuclear war plan. But in addition to executing the nuclear war plan, before you can do that, the weapons have to be unlocked. We have permissive action links on all of our weapons. And one of the myths that is assumed in the West by a lot of people is that the Russians must also have permissive action links because we have them. So we've mirror imaged that. But there was a time when we didn't have permissive action links on anything. You know, during the Eisenhower administration, we never had them. And the only reason we have permissive action links is because of one man, a friend of mine who I've worked for on the EMP Commission, on the Strategic Posture Commission, called Dr. John Foster, who's now 100 years old, but still brilliant. And he was the director of Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
You've talked about him before.
And Dr. Foster has...
Yeah.
Actually designed most of the nuclear weapons that are in our arsenal.
Huh.
And he took a tour of, during the Eisenhower administration, to stop the Soviet threat in the aftermath of World War II. We had pulled most of our boys home, and the economies and armies of Western Europe were still shattered and not recovered from World War II. And there was a grave concern that the Soviets might just roll over Western Europe and take it all over. So to stop that and to save money both in the United States and among our European allies, Eisenhower had adopted the new look for our army, all the services, and we had lots of tactical nuclear weapons that were deployed to Western Europe, and we planned on fighting a nuclear war, a tactical nuclear war, to stop the Soviet tank armies. So we would use nuclear firepower, which was a lot less expensive than having to match them division per division in Western Europe.
More bang for the buck? Is that where that came from? Yeah.
Pardon?
Is that more bang for the buck? Is that where that expression came from?
Yeah, more bang for the buck. Exactly. That was the phrase. And so with relatively few forces, you know, we would be able to defeat the Soviet armored spearheads. At least that was the theory of the new look.
Hmm.
And when Dr. Foster was touring the nuclear tactical nuclear weapon storage concerns, you know, we had thousands of tactical nuclear artillery shells and the Davy Crockett and all kinds of nuclear tactical nuclear weapons that he had developed to implement this strategy. And he got worried that what if somebody stole one of these things, you know? And so he convinced President Kennedy, one man, Dr. John Foster, said, you know, we really need to put locks on these. He basically invented the permissive action link and gave a personal briefing to President Kennedy and convinced the president, because the Pentagon, the military, didn't want to do it. They were
afraid
of putting permissive action links on our forces because they thought it would slow them up and make us more vulnerable to a surprise attack.
Hmm.
And so this idea that's widespread among our political scientists and so-called academic nuclear experts, they assume everybody has got permissive action links on their forces because it's as if it's just a common sense thing, and that any institution, you know, even a military institution is going to say, oh, if you've got a nuclear weapon, you've got to put a permissive action link on it, have a lock on it, so that it can be unlocked and used. But that is not true. When you look at the history of how the permissive action links came into being and how our unlocking codes came into being, you know, if it weren't for Dr. Foster, we might never have put permissive action links and unlocking codes on our nuclear weapons. The Pentagon didn't want them. You know, they were concerned that it would interfere with their military utility. But
and their
fortunately,
power.
He was listened to by
yeah.
President Kennedy. And so we have them today on all of our forces, including our strategic forces.
Well,
we don't know if the Russians have got them on any of their forces. You know, we just, most people assume they have them because we've got them. But there's a lot of evidence that the Russians are still, that they're thinking about how to manage nuclear weapons is the same as we had under the Eisenhower administration before the introduction of permissive action links. That, you know, basically physical security of the weapon, you know, that it's guarded, that weapons are sitting inside of, attached to ICBMs inside of silos, that basically through the physical security, the protecting of the weapons, the human guards and all the rest, the barbed wire fences, that's enough, that you don't need to actually put a lock on the warheads themselves. You know, that the way you because the nuclear weapons are all in very secure environments, you don't have to do more than that. And for sure, there was a category of our weapons where we didn't have permissive action links, even after Dr. Foster for a long time. And this was true of the Soviet weapons, for sure, which was on the ballistic missile submarines. You know, those things were never locked up, you know, because we were the whole point of the ballistic missile submarine, you know, was to provide, in case our leadership was attacked, in case Washington was wiped out, you know, the submarine commander had the independent ability to launch a retaliatory strike. You know, putting permissive action links on them that had to be unlocked from Washington would have defeated the whole purpose of having these very expensive ballistic missile submarines at sea. And so even our ballistic missile submarines were not locked up until the Clinton administration. And that was actually done in response to a movie. I think it was called Red Tide with Gene Hackman. And, you know, where they – and the story was that there was a big argument. I think it was Denzel Washington, who's his first officer in the movie. There's an argument over whether they've received an emergency action message or not to execute the forces. And Gene Hackman wants to launch the missiles,
that.
And Denzel Washington doesn't want him to. and there's a potential mutiny on board the ship. But anyway, after that movie, the Clinton administration locked up the ballistic missile submarine so that a submarine commander can't independently launch the forces. So very late in our history, up until the Clinton suit, we had a very important part of our deterrent that didn't have permissive action links on it. So it's really an erroneous assumption to say, oh, yeah, all the Russian nuclear weapons are locked up. They're probably not. They're probably not, you know, because the Russians, their highest priority was never stopping a nuclear war through miscalculation or accident. Their experience during World War II and throughout their history of being surprised by the enemy and almost defeated because of enemy surprise attacks drove them in a different direction, where their highest priority has always been to execute, to not be surprised, and to have positive control that is so great that they will never fail to execute the forces. The highest priority for them is to launch those missiles, not to make sure they're not to protect against a mistaken launch of the missiles. Right. And anything that gets in the way of being able to execute those missiles is pushed aside. I'll shut up for a moment because I'm going
on
too
long.
No,
this is fascinating. This has been an amazing discussion because I'm thinking in Russia, the biggest crime would be to not launch, if you're supposed to.
Exactly.
Whereas the biggest crime here would be to launch no matter what the situation. But I got some questions on this passive action. This is fascinating. So this nuclear football, this communication device, is it tested? Do they
oh, yes.
run it?
Yes.
Okay, so they're not testing our nuclear missiles, but they're testing the football. Is somebody there with it to explain to Brandon how it works? Should he need to actually use
there's
it?
There's a colonel who, yes, and that's his one job. I'm sure it's not just one colonel. They probably work
well, no,
an 8-hour,
gonna stand outside
6-hour
door.
Shift.
So when Brandon's right. asleep and he's napping in Chesapeake Bay or wherever he is in Delaware for his long weekends, is there somebody there in the house with him with this? I mean, do they follow him around at breakfast and during his nap time in the afternoon? Is it always there? Is there somebody always with him 24-hour day?
Yes. Yes. They always have to be, physically present, with him. And there have been times – like during the Clinton administration, when that protocol was upset and it was cause for some scandal, but yeah, they're supposed to
well,
be.
Well, when Clinton went off with a girlfriend, or what?
So that
when Clinton took off with a girlfriend, he wasn't there,
sure,
or what?
Exactly, sure, what
you
was,
can say
but
it.
I guess.
Yeah.
I guess one of the guys with the football got left. Got
behind.
Was he was sort of he got left behind or. he was in a car. He wasn't in the same car. He was too far away in terms of being able to get hold of the president, with the presidential football. Now, on the Russian side, I don't want to leave people with the impression that their system, this profound philosophical difference between our sides, where we don't want to, where we have gone – Our focus has been on making sure that you don't have a nuclear war by accident and a mistake isn't made. Okay. The Russian system has got a lot of different features from ours. For one thing, their system, the Cheged, they have three. In our case, the president is the only one, who can execute those forces, the commander-in-chief. But they have three people who can execute the Russian forces, the president, the defense minister, and the chief of the general staff. And the left, the anti-nuclear activists, and then there was even an article in Scientific American, that got this all wrong. And it has been misrepresented that, on their side, in order so that there'll be no mistake, all three of those guys have to agree before they can launch. And that is not true.
Yeah.
That's not true. That's not why they have three guys on their Cheged. The reason they have the three people is because in case of a surprise attack, so that they're so that their president, their leader, killed. You know, they're supposed to be in different places all the time. The president, the chief of the general staff, and the defense minister, and they're there so that at least one of them, if they survive, will be able to execute the forces. So any one of those three, unlike on our system, any one of those three guys can execute the forces. Now, and beyond that, there's other quite extraordinary things that are almost like science fiction, okay, about the Russian system because of their paranoia about surprise attack. You know, there's, it amuses me, but also angers me to see this misinformation in the Western press about the Russian system to say, oh, they have many, you know, there are multiple people in the loop. And there can be multiple people in the loop, but in the same way that there are on our side, you know, that gives a false impression that somebody is going to stop Putin from launching the forces. No, there's that's even less likely on the Russian side than it would be for President Biden. You know, these the people who are in charge of executing, of launching Russia's nuclear forces and doing the command and control steps that are necessary are the elite of the elite. They're the best paid. They're the top-notch. Unlike in our system, by the way, you know, STRATCOM, you know, is not considered, you know, the best of the best in the elite. It's subordinate to the Air Force, which we never should have.
STRATCOM.
We should have kept the Strategic Air Command.
Strategic Air Command. Okay,
the,
I know
the
that
the Strategic Command. The that's headed up by Admiral Charles Richard. He's the commander-in-chief of our nuclear deterrent.
An admiral?
STRATCOM is basically, yes, yeah. Well, that's not surprising. The ballistic missile submarines have most of the nuclear threat.
Oh, okay. I was thinking Air Force General, you know, but okay, that makes sense. All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's not limited to, you know, it can be anybody from, you know, from the Air Force or, but in this case, we have an admiral who's our STRATCOM commander. But STRATCOM is not given, you know, the kind of priority that the strategic rocket forces in Russia receives. You know, they get the most money, they get the best equipment, their people are trained like robots. So there's much less, whatever slight chance there might be for somebody disobeying an order, that chance is much less on the Russian side than it is on ours because of all of this controversy about whether one man should be in charge of executing the forces. But to make sure those forces execute, they've got three people who can independently execute the Russian forces, launch those Russian forces if they think they need to do it. And on top of that, they can structure their forces in such a way that almost all the human actors are eliminated. The Russians, to ensure positive control, to ensure that those forces get launched, have a system called the Automated Launch System, or ALS, and everything is wired. All the ICBMs are wired back into the General Staff Command Post, and we don't have anything like that. You know, the wires from our Minuteman launch control facilities are limited to our don't go beyond our wings. You know, each our ICBMs are organized in wings. And we don't have a hard nuclear hardened cable that goes all the way from our ICBM wings back to some underground command post near Washington. But the Russians do. It's called the Automated Launch System. And if the launch control officers are ordered to turn on the ALS, they're now out of the loop. So none of those guys, you know, have anything to do with the forces anymore. And they can all be launched from the General Staff Command Post. So that basically does put it in a situation where literally one person could actually execute those forces, you know, from the General Staff Command Post. And that so maybe the most important guy in Russia is not Putin, but the chief of the General Staff, you know, who's in that command post. But, of course, Putin
who is that?
Would be in that command post.
Do you know who that is right now?
I don't remember who it is. Karakayev, I think. I think it's a General Karakayev at this time.
I'm
not sure.
I
don't remember.
Yeah, because a couple of movies come to mind. One is the Hunt for Red October, where they studied Sean Connery playing a Russian, but he was Lithuanian, so he wasn't a confirmed Russian. He ended up defecting with a nuclear submarine. Pretty improbable, actually, but still made for a good story. But they really studied him. I think studying the personalities is fascinating. As to who these people are. I really studied Putin, but I want to know who these other people are. Because you mentioned something very interesting before, and Claire Lopez used to talk about this when she was on, that the Chinese and the Russians, you know, you don't walk into the defense secretary position, you know, like here, they're political hacks. I mean, Lloyd Austin's a political hack. You know, he was in Raytheon, board of directors, now he's secretary of defense. But I think in Russia and in the communist countries, you're from birth or shortly thereafter for these positions. You know, so these are the top people in these countries doing it. So it makes sense, you know, that they would have probably more authority because they've been bred for this. That's their job. That's all they've ever thought about, done, been trained for, is to work this nuclear thing. And as you said earlier, and we talked about, the greater crime is not launching when you should rather than launching when you shouldn't, you know. And so it's a totally different orientation. Yeah, go ahead.
That's right. And Claire is absolutely right about that. It's just also interesting in the Russian system. In our system, the successor to our president would be the vice president, and then the successor to him, you know, would be the I think the Speaker of the House. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So we've got a civilian, and chain of succession. I don't think it ever includes a military officer. It's always a civilian, you know, that belongs to the administration. I think that we had an exercise where Elizabeth Dole, when she was Secretary of Transportation, was the person who was in the chain of succession. But on the Russian side, you know, well, first of all, one could hardly call Putin a civilian since he's really a former KGB guy, okay? So he obviously comes from their national security apparatus, but all the people that are in charge of that are from their national security apparatus and their military, who, of course, have the most paranoid worldviews and, are completely unexposed to the kind of anti-nuclear sentiments that exist among here in the United States that are so widespread among us, from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and Union of Concerned Scientists. I mean, they have nothing like that in Russia that would contaminate, you know, the views of these hard-line military officers. The defense minister is not a civilian, or if he was, you know, he's always a former general, and of course the chief of the general staff is a serving general. So in their system, the guys in charge of pushing the button, as it were, are basically all military or from the national security apparatus, and are going to have the perspective that the Russians have, who serve in their national security environment, which is one of extreme paranoia and concern about being surprised.
Well, it's almost justified paranoia, too. You know, we understand that there's paranoia, but I also understand why they have that paranoia. And it makes sense, even though, you know, I don't want them to be paranoid. It makes perfect sense why they feel the way they do. But we have to take that into account. We have to understand their paranoia, not deny it. And I think that's the big problem. We deny
exactly,
it.
Exactly, which is why we shouldn't be having this reckless confidence that we can do whatever we want in Ukraine and continue to escalate and stoke that war, and nothing bad is going to happen.
Oh, please.
I absolutely agree. Now, to go further with this, the other thing they have done in the Russian command and control system that has, you know, no counterpart is their forces can be executed with no person in the loop at all, you know, where there's no human being in the loop. They have a system called Perimeter. Mm-hmm. It's also called Dead Hand. All right, and fortunately, it has to be. We think it has to be turned on. We think it's not operating all the time. But if they turn on the Dead Hand, you know, then you've got a computer in charge, and this is to provide additional positive control to make sure the forces are executed in case of a surprise attack. If a surprise attack kills everybody, and you anticipated that maybe they're going to surprise us, and maybe this is what Putin did on February 27th when he ordered this special combat alert. Our intelligence community, we don't know what that is. We've never heard of that before, but we know they did something, and possibly the thing they did was to turn on perimeter, the dead hand, so that just in case there's a surprise, this thing escalates and there's a surprise attack that kills the top military and political leaders who would normally execute the forces, the perimeter system will do it and execute whatever plan has been programmed into it. It can launch all of the forces, or it can launch some of them.
And that can't be stopped once it's started, or is there a permissive action link on that at all? It being a computer,
we don't know. You know, we don't know. I'm sure it's tied into the automated launch system, so that basically it's probably located in the general staff command post. But who knows? There are 1,500 of these deep underground bunkers that belong to the political military elite. It may be in many of them, and probably is for redundancy. But we have been told, we don't know and can't independently verify it, mm-hmm. but it's supposed to be, they're supposed to turn it on. So fortunately, if that's true, that's kind of a permissive action link, that it has to be turned on. It's not operating all the time.
Yeah. I was just going to bring up another movie, War Games. You ever see that with Dabney Coleman and Matthew Broderick, where they had a computer?
I've heard about it, but no, I haven't seen that.
You should. It's pretty silly in a lot of ways, but what they talk about is a computer automated defense because it can make decisions faster than people. And what it ends up doing is they simulated war games, and it mistakes a simulated game for a real one. So you're playing a game with this thing, but it's actually getting the missiles ready to launch. It's about ready to go, and it thinks it's just doing another simulation. And that was the problem with it, was that it confused reality with a simulation, and that was the whole issue of the movie. And this is why I'm not crazy about automated computers. I still want a human being involved just in case.
Right. That's the feeling on our side as well, although there are a lot of people that are arguing for including computers, artificially intelligent computers, you know, mm-hmm. because of the hypersonic warhead problem, that our people can't respond quickly enough. And so there have been serious proposals that we incorporate artificially intelligent computers into a command control system, to compensate for the human frailties that we can't respond. And that's to things like hypersonic weapons that have, as we've talked about in previous shows, are cutting down on the decision-making timeline that's available mm-hmm. to us, and kind of rendering human beings obsolete in terms of the way the Cold War command control system worked.
Which brings up another movie, Terminator, Skynet, where the machines determined.
Have you ever seen?
Go ahead.
There was another movie that's more relevant to this, I think, than War Games, uh-huh. called Colossus, the Forbin Project. That was made many years ago, I think.
Okay,
there's and they talk about, I think that was made in the 70s. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but it's a really mm-hmm. good movie where they talk about an artificially intelligent computer called Colossus that is put in charge of our nuclear forces, mm-hmm. and the Russians have one too. They mm-hmm. end up coming up with a system as well, and the two systems conspire to make a nuclear war against mankind to wipe us out. But anyway, that sounds a lot like Terminator, you know, and Skynet and all that.
It's fascinating what they play with. But, you know, if you remember on Star Trek, which came out in the 60s, they had those communicators that were a flip thing with the antenna popped up. And then eventually we had flip phones. You know, it's not that far removed. It's kind of interesting. I've got succession
here. I would mention,
go ahead,
when I was studying history in graduate school, mm-hmm. there was a course on the novel as the history of the future. Because a really good case can be made that the novelistic imagination, these fiction writers, actually come up with a lot of predictions that turn out to be true, you mm-hmm. know, like and many years before the scientists anticipate it. For example, H.G. Wells, in the early 1900s, I'm not sure if Einstein had published his theory of relativity yet or not, but H.G. Mm-hmm. Wells anticipated the atomic bomb before anybody did. in one of his
That's
novels.
Interesting.
Right, and so yeah, there's a lot of interesting developments.
One
shouldn't blow it off just because it's a work of fiction or it shows up in a movie. You know, the fictional imagination, the novelistic imagination, you know, is often usually they're trying to deal with some reality and extrapolate about what could be, and sooner or later, in many cases, it becomes true. Now, let me talk about the worst part about the Russian command and control system, and that's the Vryon computer. There's another computer system called Vryon, and this stands for Surprise Nuclear Missile Attack. You know, and it is even more concerned than the perimeter dead hand system with making sure that Russia doesn't get surprised. We know the Vryon thing was both an intelligence program as well and the minimum is an advisory system on launching a first strike. When do they launch a first strike? So that they don't go second, because that's another obsession of the Russian military doctrine. You know, not only don't they want to be surprised, but they don't want to be surprised so that they don't go second. They want to be the ones that go first, you know. I've been involved in nuclear exchange modeling analysis all of my life and all of my professional life. And one of the truisms that comes out of nuclear exchange modeling analysis is almost regardless of scenario, is he who strikes first wins.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the Russians have done the calculations as well, and it's just common sense that if you are striking first, you've got a much better chance of winning than going second, because the destructive effects of nuclear weapons are so devastating. You know, I mean, the idea that you can absorb a nuclear attack and then retaliate, which is what our strategy is based on, is a very optimistic and hopeful kind of a strategy. But Vryon collects the KGB and the GRU. It's got hundreds of thousands of indicators, and the KGB and GRU sweep the world, you know, like a vacuum cleaner for data on all kinds of information about the West that they have decided is relevant to the possibility of nuclear war happening.
Mm-hmm.
Much of this data does make sense, like, you know, the DEFCON level of U.S. strategic forces, the political military situation in the world, like is there a big war going on in Europe, like in Ukraine. But a lot of the data also is not really sensible from a realistic point of view, but it's sort of passed through the lens of the Russian perception of how the West works. For example, you know, they think that hospitals are all organized and answer to some entity in the federal government, and so that when you have blood bank drives, a local blood bank drive by hospital, that has been decided in Washington somewhere, that they've got to have blood bank drives. And so, you know, because you need – one of the things you do in preparation for a nuclear war is increase the blood supply, you know, so that you can have transfusions against radiation sickness. Another indicator is the price of gold, because the capitalists know, the rich people who are close to the president and are part of the power elite, are probably going to know, you know, when a nuclear war is going to happen. And so they're going to, you know, want to buy gold
nuclear war?
No, you know, honestly.
Oh, please.
And this is – that was –
Charles Schwab recommends.
That's not an
– In case of nuclear
that's
war.
That's an actual indicator. And, you know, and there are a lot of things like that that actually don't make sense, but they think it makes sense. And,
nuclear psychology is fascinating. It's backward. You know, you have to attack so you don't get attacked. You have to plan for a nuclear war, but it's impossible to survive because everything gets destroyed. I mean, I'm just throwing these things out. But it's a fascinating psychology. So here's my question that I'm thinking of too. Knowing, the Russians knowing that our strategy is absorb a nuclear attack and retaliate in a kind of backwards way, wouldn't that make them more confident because they know they're going to go first? Does that figure into their planning?
Well, they don't know because they don't believe it. You know, when you read their doctrine, and it doesn't help that we have the anti-nuclear left interpreting every new U.S. military modernization system, especially nuclear systems. You know, there are whole books written on how the United States plans to go first in reality. And there's a good recent example, as a matter of fact. There's a fuse, a new fuse that we came up with, a proximity fuse, to try to improve the ability of our missiles to destroy hard targets. Okay, and we've done that because we haven't modernized our forces. You know, we aren't building new, more accurate missiles and new, more accurate warheads. But the Pentagon could get away with this. But this was one thing that kind of got around the political correctness from Pentagon lawyers, where they were able to introduce this fuse, which slightly increases the effectiveness of some of our missiles to attack hard targets. And the Union of Concerned Scientists pointed to that as an example of our planning to make a nuclear first strike. During the Reagan administration, when Reagan compensated for the big advantages that Russia had in the numbers of nuclear weapons, we came up with a cheap system, the cruise missile, the air-launched cruise missile. Instead of focusing on the fact that this was clearly a second strike weapon because it has to be delivered by bombers, you know, it can't be launched from the continental United States, it has to be carried by B-52s and then launched outside. But instead of focusing on that, the Union of Concerned Scientists talks about the stealthy nature of the cruise missile because it can fly below radar at low altitudes, suited for a surprise attack. And that's how the Russians think about it too, of course, but it doesn't help our credibility. And it defeats, actually, a really important purpose of arms control on the side of the United States, because we have the nuclear triad we have was not designed and built by the most hawkish nuclear warfighters, people like me, okay? If I designed our triad, I would have designed it differently. I would have made
it much like
the Russians.
No. So how would you design it? I'm curious, given our country here. What would you do? I'm really curious about that.
I would have a heavy ICBM in our missile silos, you know, like the Russians have got, like the 18-5 or the Satan II that they planted with multiple, MIRV warheads. I'd give them yield accuracy combinations so that they could destroy Russian hard targets.
Okay.
I would have earth-penetrating warheads so that they could have high assuredness of destroying deep underground bunkers so that whoever started a nuclear war on the Russian side wouldn't survive it. I think that's the single most important deterrent, to be able to kill the military political leaders in those 1,500 bunkers. You know, they can protect 150,000, 300,000 of top political military elites. You know, we need to be able to kill those people. We can't right now with the arsenal that we've got. Our triad is the triad that arms control built. It's all designed for transparency. We want them to see that we don't have a first strike capability on our ICBMs. All the Minuteman III's have only one warhead, and they have yield accuracy combinations that make them very unsuited for destroying hard targets. You know, they can destroy hard targets, but not to like 90% probability, you know. The Russian silos are much harder than ours. You know, a Minuteman III would be lucky to destroy 25% of the Russian ICBM silos. I would have mobile ICBMs like they do, you know, that are very hard to take out because you don't know where they are. And that makes a surprise attack much harder. I'd have a very small bomber force. The bombers are just not that useful in nuclear war fighting, but arms controllers love them because it takes 3 days to mobilize the bomber force. And so you can use them for political signaling, or at least in theory you can. The fact of the matter is there's so much resistance to ever mobilizing our nuclear forces to a survivable posture that we almost never do it. The ballistic missile submarine fleet is extremely vulnerable. I would I'd put a lot less emphasis on ballistic missile submarines than we have. Or if I'm going to have ballistic missile submarines, I'd build a lot more of them and base them in many more bases and spread out our bombers in many more bases. We had at least 45 bomber bases during the Cold War. You know, today we've only got three. Much easier. Even North Korea could take out the bomber force and the ballistic missile submarine force. We've only got two ballistic missile submarine ports. I'd increase the operational tempo. Of course, you need to modernize the ballistic missile submarines to do that, so that, like during the Cold War, we'd have at least 50% of them at sea all the time. The Slickum, I would multiply. We need to have at least 2,000 Slickums. That is ship-launched cruise missiles to compensate for the big Russian advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. You know, over and over again on this show, we've talked about how we have almost no tactical nuclear weapons anymore. You know, we've only got 100 to 200 of them, obsolete gravity bombs that are bunk in NATO Europe. And we probably couldn't even use them because we need the permission of host governments to take them out of their bunkers. And the host governments are supposed to deliver them. So, you know, they're so anti-nuclear over there in Europe that it's almost guaranteed that those forces are not usable from a realistic perspective. Of course, the Russians don't see it that way. They, you know, they see that as another evidence. They find twisted ways of rationalizing that as further evidence of us preparing for a surprise attack against them. I mean, it's just like with the Democratic Party here in the United States. You know, whatever the Democrats say the Republicans and Trump voters are doing, that's what they have done, and that's what they plan to do. And it's the same thing with the Russians. They plan to launch a surprise nuclear attack. That's how they plan to. So they see, they mirror image onto us their own philosophies and doctrines, just the same way as we have had many people within our own State Department convincing themselves that we have trained the Russians to think as we do. That's why we're so reluctant to acknowledge when they're cheating on arms control treaties. You know, it's up to the State Department to do that. And every time they have to admit that the Russians have violated an arms control treaty, it really undermines the Washington worldview among those who think, oh, the Russians think the same way we do. They believe in mutual assured destruction. They believe in arms control. They believe nobody can fight and win a nuclear war. You know, I mean, that's the prevailing view in Washington. And everybody is always in Washington is always reluctant to admit, you know, when one of these arms control treaties, you know, has been violated. And frankly, all of them have been violated. Probably the New START treaty, too, is the last treaty that the State Department continues to insist hasn't been violated, which is just so counterintelligent. Yeah. I mean, why should they be honoring that treaty when they've broken all the other treaties? It's the single arguably the most important treaty, and they wouldn't violate that treaty, especially since we have such poor verification provisions. You know, we really can't verify that the treaty is being complied with.
Let me jump in real quickly here because Emily Nunez is on the line. I want to see if we can get you guys together for a couple of minutes here. She's the one who's running for Florida State House of Representatives. Emily, do you have a question for Dr. Pryor? I don't know if you had a chance to listen to any of this previous hour. I want to see if I want to give this opportunity before Dr. Pryor has to leave us. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you for having me this morning. No, I just unfortunately logged in. I did not have an opportunity to listen to the last hour.
Okay. I'll send it to you. Well, you have the link to it, too. Dr. Pryor, do you want to take a couple minutes, maybe repeat what you said at the beginning of the show, or if you have a message for our state legislative candidate here?
Yes, I do. And I say this as a person who is soon to be a permanent resident of Florida, because I want to be in the last free state in the United States. You know, the only thing holding me up is I haven't passed the Florida driver's license test yet. You know, I have to get a pair of bifocal glasses, but I will soon this year be a permanent resident of Florida. I've got a house down in Boca Raton, going to be among your constituency, okay? But anybody who comes on to the Greg Penglis show is all right in my book, and and I will find ways to support you in any way I can. Now, I have given to Greg to pass on to you a draft executive order for protecting the Florida electric grid against electromagnetic pulse and cyber warfare. And I think that should really be a highest priority, both for the governor and for the state legislature, to see that the Florida electric grid is protected from all hazards, but especially from cyber warfare and electromagnetic pulse attack, because Florida was specifically signaled out for attack by cyber and EMP. To make an example of Florida, to demonstrate their cyber power, if the United States interfered, as the Russians put it, if we interfered in the Ukraine war, they said this back in April 2021 and said, I've written a book that includes this in it. It's called Blackout Warfare. The Russians have in their military doctrine, you know, they have this revolutionary new way of warfare that's focused on blacking out electric grids. Because if you take out the civilian grid, you can't project military power. You know, it's the most painful thing you can do to the people, because immediately there's no water. You'll start running out of food within a matter of days. It's a way of bringing a whole society to its knees. And we're extremely vulnerable to that because our grid is not protected. And they have specifically, as I said, mentioned Florida as a target for this in the event that the United States became involved in the Ukraine war. And as you know, we are involved in the Ukraine war. We're getting more deeply involved. And the first people to suffer may be the people of Florida, since they talked about making us an example. They also talked about blacking out the whole U.S. electric grid, the national electric grid, which they could also do. So anyway, I asked to think about that. Greg will give you an executive order that I wrote
for
Governor DeSantis.
Okay.
And that executive order could easily be translated. I don't know if the governor will implement it. You know, I was asked for it by his staff, and I provided it. But it could be easily translated into legislation. And probably the best way to proceed would be to coordinate between the governor's office and yourself, if you get elected, to pass a bill simultaneously with the issuance of that executive order to protect the people of Florida from this existential threat.
Absolutely. Well, I will be happy to take a look at that. If Greg can, I'll give him my email and he can send that over. And thank you for your support and welcome, or soon to be welcome, to the free state of Florida. And I plan on helping the governor keep it that way.
Good. We need to keep it that way. Maybe we can take back the whole country from the brave little state of Florida.
Absolutely.
All right. Dr. Fry, anything else? I know we kind of caught you mid-sentence on anything else. Anything to sum up for what's happening here? This has been a fascinating hour. So, Emily, you can get the podcast done. You can check out this hour when you get a chance. It's been unbelievably revealing of some of the nuclear things I didn't know. Dr. Fry, anything else forecast for this week, preview of next week?
Well, next week I'd like to talk about why the Russians have done so poorly in Ukraine.
That would be
mostly it's been attributed to the incompetence of the Russian army, and I think that needs to be unpackaged a little more. I think what we're seeing is a revolution in military affairs happening that wasn't anticipated by anybody, including us, and that's probably why the Russians aren't doing so well. We may be witnessing the passing of the tank as a effective means of fighting wars on the battlefield, you know, because of the dominance of unmanned aerial vehicles, things like the Switchblade missiles and the like, which are really transforming the battlefields in ways that even have surprised everybody. We're attributing to, the Russians are incompetent, they don't know how to, and therefore we can push them over and we don't have to worry about getting in a conventional war with them. when in fact, you know, I think these new technologies are probably the real reason the Russian army has been stalled.
That's really interesting. I have to let you go, though, because I want to get to Emily. We're really jam-packed today. It's quite interesting. But I want to thank you for an incredible discussion this last hour. It's really been enlightening in so many ways. So thank you, sir.
Yes. Let's hope that that special order that Putin made on February 27 didn't turn on the Grian system. Then
yeah.
We're really in trouble, okay, because then Putin isn't even in charge. But,
yep.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, too, sir. We'll talk next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Dr. Peter Pry, and it's just he's been with us, I think, since the beginning, and it's just been an invaluable resource on national security and so many other areas. Well, let's get to our guest of the day, Emily Nunez. Well, I got a theme for you. I got to get introduced with music and stuff like that. So Emily and I have been communicating Facebook messages back and forth, all these kind of things like that. I want to have her on. Because anybody that's running for the House, anybody that's you know, a good, strong conservative person, you know, military veteran, also a broadcaster, writer, you know, all the different things she does, I was curious. And so we're going to investigate all those things this hour and hopefully more hours. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Let's get you a little cheer. So we definitely have our fun here. Yeah, it's I'm just coming off a huge hour with Dr. Pry, and of course we had an hour before that. So by the time we get to the third hour, I'm like, oh boy, you know, this is so much you know, in my head right now, swimming around. Well, let's get your story. So I wanted sort of like three segments. You've got your military service, which is wonderful. I want to find out about that. You've got a whole bunch of broadcast and writing things that you do, editing, and then you became a state legislative House candidate. So I want to kind of take those in segments and get them. So let's talk about military, what you did, what you learned, why you went in, as much as you can about your job there, the state of the military, things like that. So I'm just going to let you go and just kind of tell us a story.
Okay. Well, I enlisted into the United States Navy right out of high school. So 2 weeks after I got my degree, I was off to boot camp, and I enlisted as an aviation maintenance administration. And so essentially I took care of all of the logbooks and records for aircraft. Is very much like, you know, when you take your car into the auto shop, you know, whenever you get any sort of maintenance done on it, you have someone that's logging it, tracking it when you need to do it again. And so it's very similar for aircraft. And so that's what I essentially did. So my first duty station with the Navy was in Mitsuki, Japan. I did some deployments on the USS Kitty Hawk. I was with the F-18 squadron there. And it was a lot of fun. Got to see the
world.
Did
you get to fly in one? Did you get to fly in one?
I did not get to fly in one there, but I did get to fly in one. So after I left Japan, I went to Pensacola, Florida, and I worked with the United States Navy Blue Angels. And in your last tour of working with the Blue Angels, doing the air shows, you do get to do a back seat ride in one of the aircraft. So I did
end up doing
a back seat ride.
I did not do it
with in my first duty station, but in my second duty station, I did. And unfortunately, I wasn't hydrated enough when I went up, and so it didn't turn out very well in the beginning. But I worked my way through it. I got a little sick.
Well,
do
you have like
hydrated,
a connection? You know, I've watched the Blue Angels since I was 5 years old. I wanted to be a military pilot. I soloed at 16. I had my license at 17. And I had my eyesight went to like 2100 at 19. So I was into glasses. And of course that canceled any military flying career, much to my deep, you know, trauma at the time. I was really upset.
Yeah.
I worked my whole life for this. Now, I haven't given up that dream. I still want my own jet. I still want to fly upside down over Pensacola Beach. And I would love to get my Blue Angels ride. Does that feel like one? Just get me up. I want to go supersonic upside down. That's it. Big request, but if you we can talk after the show and see
okay,
if
sounds good.
You know,
now
that I'm media. Okay.
You get a media ride.
I'll get a media ride.
Action
radio is going to replace talk radio. I'm convinced that we're going to make talk radio obsolete. Don't tell them that. They'll get all upset.
Okay.
Anyway. So state of the aircraft. So you're logging. If I just ask a question on this, because I'm curious about so many things. So, you know, we hear about spare parts and things like that under the Obama administration. They weren't tracking them properly. Could you see, as much as you can reveal, I don't want classified stuff, but could you see problems over time with things like spare parts and not replacing, you know, were different administrations showing different interest in the military in a way that you could see directly in terms of the log, the amount of maintenance that had to be done? Just curious.
No, I mean, I can't, I don't know what the state, I got out of the military in December of 16. So, you know, we certainly didn't experience any of those issues. And, you know, well ahead of time, whenever those major repairs that are going to down the aircraft for a while are coming. And so there's plenty of time to plan for those major overhauls. But no, I can't say it was a problem then, and I'm not, you know, I have no idea what they're experiencing right now, but, you know, I wouldn't imagine that the military is always a priority with getting the parts and supplies that it needs to make sure that we're ready to go to war, take on the fight. So
I
can't say that.
Okay. All right. So Navy, and then you got to the Marines at some point. How'd that work out?
I did. So at the end of my tour with the Blue Angels, I was selected for an officer commissioning program. It's called Seaman to Admiral. And so I, the military paid for me to finish my undergraduate degree. So I went to Auburn University to finish my undergraduate degree in business administration. And then at that point in time, I was allowed to, I was exploring, you know, the Navy and the Marine Corps, the programs and the jobs offered in each. And it turned out that I could actually pursue a job in the, you know, in the Marine Corps as an officer, as long as I went through the officer, you know, candidate school and the, you know, all of the other trainings that officers had to do. So, you know, I just felt like I'd seen the Navy, I had experienced it, you know, I'd worked with the best of the best at the Blue Angels, seen the world. And so maybe it was, you know, time to give myself a new challenge. And when you think that the Marine Corps, it's always, you know, the best of the best again. And, you know, to see how mentally and physically tough you are. And so I decided to go for that. And I commissioned in the Marine Corps, went through all the training, and ended up back in Okinawa, Japan for my last tour of duty as a communications officer. But really, I ended up kind of just working as the an adjutant at that squadron. So,
what's an adjutant?
An adjutant is kind of, if you want to compare it to like a human resource officer, you take care of all the paperwork for personnel when they're coming to the command, when they're leaving the command, travel, reimbursement for travel, all of those sorts of things.
Interesting. So what rank did you end up with and how long were you in the military?
I was in the military for 12 years. I started off as an E3. And finished as a lieutenant in the Marine Corps.
Interesting. Okay. And what? How did that change your life?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the military was a great opportunity, and you know, I had no other way, other avenue, you know, to end up with a master's degree in business administration. Now, you know, without, you know, the programs offered through the military. I actually grew up thinking that I was a Democrat, but really, you know, love of country, discipline, hard work, you know, showed me that I'm not, you know, that I'm definitely a conservative. A lot of my family actually, they are Democrats, but I'm definitely not. So, you know, it just showed me that, and a lot of opportunities can be granted to people who are ready to go in and, you know, do the hard work that needs to be done. And you meet a lot of great friends. So actually, one of the things I miss is being able to wear the uniform, you know, wear the uniform every day. In the civilian world, you have to, you know, change outfits, you can't wear the same thing more than once, twice, and all this different stuff. You know, it's so much easier when you can wear the same thing every day.
Yeah, nobody cares. You don't have the fashion maven. It's interesting, yeah. This is funny, that you know, Democrats, there's like Democrats and Democrats. I mean, John Kennedy was a Democrat. I don't think you're going to find anybody that loved this country more than John Kennedy. The fact that he was a Democrat, you know, what I call like the classic Democrat, he had a vision. You know, and Ronald Reagan started off as a Democrat. So Democrat isn't necessarily a bad thing. What the bad thing is are the Marxists, you know, what they become.
Yes.
The absolute leftist, woke, you know, I hate America, we're going to destroy America. You know, the people that think that it's okay to steal, I'm pretty blunt on this show, but to steal the government from Donald Trump, to replace Donald Trump with a moron, to raise our gas prices because they don't want us using oil, which is a renewable resource. And you know, we've done several shows, and we can get into all kinds of issues that you want. But the Earth makes oil. You know, hydrogen and carbon combine in the mantle to make hydrocarbons. That's oil. Okay. And, you know, so it's a perfectly natural product. When petroleum products are burned, they release CO2. Well, CO2 goes back into the air, and then it goes into plants as plant food. I mean, that's part of the carbon cycle. You know, so there's nothing wrong with the burning of petroleum because it's actually environmental. People don't think about that too.
Mm-hmm.
So all these different things are going on that the Democrats, that maybe Democrats would realize, but that the woke crowd has no clue because they want to socially engineer us into Venezuela. You know, so it's a very scary thing what's going on. So I've no problem with Democrats. With good, honest, you know, classically liberal Democrats, then we agree on policy. I mean, we disagree on policies. We disagree on a lot of things, but I don't find them disagreeable. I think we just, we both love our country. We have different ways of looking at it. You know, they like the Constitution, I like the Constitution. You know, the ACLU, when they were doing what they were supposed to do, you know, protecting free speech, protecting rights, they kind of fell short on the Second Amendment, but, you know, that's a problem. But for the most part, they did pretty well, you know, from what I could see. But then they lost their way, and now they're woke Marxists. And so that's the problem.
Yes.
So but have you seen that split? Well, yeah, I mean, like I say, you don't have to talk about politics and the military, but just in your life, have you seen that kind of a split that's really dramatic?
Well, you know, I mean, we can just use the military as an example, and I've told several people this, you know, I think it's very disappointing and disheartening that you see people now trying to make these claims that, you know, there's white rage in the military and that there's racism and that there's all these things. Well, you know, we all wore the same uniform. We all bled, you know, red, white, and blue. We were all family. There were not these, you know, invisible boogeymen that the Democrats or the Marxists are creating. You know, there was no, you know, paying for transgender surgery. There were very clear cut lines. You know, I just, you know, we just had the anniversary of D-Day, you know, and I made a statement that, you know, the military that we used to have, you know, they didn't stop the mission for a virus with a 98% survival rate. You know, the generals weren't,
it's like
the generals weren't woke.
Yeah.
You know, like we didn't have our veterans weren't looked at as victims. They weren't, you know, they didn't need a safe space. You know, they didn't need any of these things. They were men of courage, and they went and did what they were supposed to do, and they came home, and they, you know, we were extremely grateful for their courage and their sacrifice. And it just doesn't seem like that's the treatment anymore, and it's very disheartening.
No, you're absolutely right. We talked about this yesterday. We did Mama B. Thomas is on the show on Mondays now for the whole show. So we get to really talk about these issues in depth. And we're comparing, you know, the generation, the D-Day generation, the greatest generation, you know, the basically very young men, 17, 18 years old, that ran that beach. And I've seen that beach. I've been there. And so I took my daughter to Europe. And we saw the Normandy beaches. You know, we crossed over from Portsmouth, England. So basically made the same trip that they made on D-Day, you know, the real D-Day. And it was quite fascinating to do this. And the French still love Americans. Northern France, you want to go to a place where you're appreciated? Go to Northern France, okay? I went to the city of Caen, spelled C-A-E-N. And you want to talk about great appreciation. It was fascinating. And to be able to see that, they still remember. And these are kids that weren't born yet, and they still know their parents and their grandparents' stories about what happened there. But you compare that generation to the generation now, we've got mostly fatherless young men. You've got a great society program that split up families. You've got gangs. You've got what I think one of the major. Well, we might as well talk about this right now. The whole idea of these mass public shootings. The men have changed. You know, the same guns are in the same ownership, about 43% that they were in the 40s. That hasn't really changed. The guns themselves haven't really changed, but the people have changed, especially the young men. You know, we've gone from men of, you know, usually married homes. I mean, the guys that that fought on those beaches, they came from extended families. A lot of them were on farms. You know, even you know, 80 years ago, it was an entirely different culture. People loved their country, and it was good to love your country. I mean, the schools, you know, they talked about you pledge allegiance before the class began. You did all kinds of things to support your country, and going in the military was a natural thing for a lot of people. You know, now it wasn't protested. It wasn't thought of as disgusting or all the things going on today. And you didn't have mass public shootings because young men would have been immediately corrected by older men, namely their fathers. They never would have tolerated this kind of thing. So the men have changed. Now, did you, I'm curious your comments on that. And then if you saw men change in the time that you were in the military, just out of curiosity.
Well, I don't know if it's just that, too. A lot of those mass shootings happened at, you know, gun-free zones, you know. And so they're an easy target. People know that nobody there is going to be able to defend themselves because it's not allowed there. So really, I think we need to get rid of the gun-free zones, because before we instituted gun-free zones, how often did we have, you know, these mass shootings?
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, I have some gun deals.
That's the question that I have. But obviously the breakdown of the family unit has, you know, changed, you know, where we are at today as a society. You know, it's very easy now for women to not need to be married to raise a child on their own, because the government provides so many options to take care of them. So the government is actually assisting the breakup of the nuclear family by providing all of these, you know, extra avenues for them to not need a father in their life. And then, you know, the mental health we can see of these young men growing up, you know, I mean, but even take it a step further, now you have these crazy Marxists that are saying that you are completely mature enough as a five-year-old to decide if you want to be a boy or a girl, but you are not mature enough to own a gun at 18. What kind of sense does that make? You know, we have men that we put in the military at 18 who are trained to use a gun, but you know, they're not allowed to have one, or they're not mature enough to have one at 18 if they're not in the military or not. It's just nuts. It's nuts. So I definitely think they always change things to suit their agenda. So we can always expect them to behave that way. But also I think conservatives need to really start, you know, instead of being reactive, really start being proactive and getting some of these crazy ideologies under control with where they're trying to go. So
I agree with you. We've done shows on the whole idea that transgender is a personal problem. It's not a civil right. In fact, I don't even use the term transgender. You know, I think it's gender dysphoria. It's a confusion. And we say very clearly, you know, here at Action Radio that you are who you are, not who you think you are. You know, if you think you're, you know, something else, that's your problem. Okay, deal with it. It's a mental health issue, and I wish you the best, you know, to go, you know, try and figure out why you have an identity issue. But that doesn't give you the right to take other rights from other people. And what's going on in the schools, we were talking about this with Josie earlier, with our Latino report. I get to get you guys together. But was she's from Nicaragua, grew up under communism. Fascinating person to talk to. But what we've come to the conclusion, or I came to the conclusion the other day, is that this is actually pedophilia in the schools, that there is an obsession that Democrats have for children and sexualizing children and putting boys in girls' bathrooms and girls in boys' bathrooms. And I think it should be a crime. It should be an arrestable offense. You know, I think it is so bad now. It was one thing when we used to joke around that, you know, well, the Equal Rights Amendment is going to put men in women's bathrooms. And that was, we thought it was funny back in the, you know, the 80s. But now they're actually, they actually believe this stuff. They can't identify a, you know, a woman, or they can't identify anything. They basically made us genderless. My belief is they do this because they want to take away every identity you have. Because under Marxism, you have no identity. You have no individuality. So if you don't have any individuality, there's no need for individual rights. And I think this is where they're ultimately going. But on the legislative level, I'm going to jump around a little bit here because you're interesting and we can do this. But on the legislative level, would it be worth looking into whether what they're doing in these schools, these sexualizing of children, is in fact a sexual assault, is in fact a form of pedophilia, is an obsession that needs to be dealt with as a crime to stop this nonsense? What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I released a press release this morning because I'm not sure if your listeners are aware of what happened in Texas over the weekend, but children were allowed to go to a drag show at a gay bar, and there were children seen putting dollar bills in mm-hmm. the undergarments of these drag queens. So it's absolutely, it's insane. It's child abuse. Why on in any way, shape, or form would that be okay? Would that be allowed? So I've promised that if it doesn't happen before I'm elected, that I would sponsor a bill banning children to be allowed to be at any drag shows at all. It's completely nuts. I think that that's just a stepping stone, and even what they're teaching children in schools is just a stepping stone to try to normalize pedophilia. It's absolutely disgusting. None of this has a place in the classroom, and I would do everything within my power to keep it out. Fortunately, we've had Representative Aaron Grawl pass the or sponsor, and it was signed into law, the Parents' Bill of Rights in Florida. So luckily now we know for sure that, you know, what parents and teachers can and cannot do for their kids. Why we even needed a Parents' Bill of Rights is beyond me in this country, but we've reached that point to where it has to be specifically stated what some of these crazy, you know, Marxist socialist teachers are trying to impose on children. But really what's sad is that it took COVID and the shutdown of schools for Republicans to start getting involved again in the school system, because I believe that we were blindsided by it. We weren't active in our school boards for a very long time, and now we're having to go back and do major corrections on some things that were just kind of neglected on our end for a long time. And so better late than never, but we have some work to do. So
we also have work to do. That's why the show is going to be going long after I'm gone. I wrote a Parents' Bill of Rights too, but it concerned primarily the public health issue, because there was a special legislative session, I think, last November. And so I wrote two bills. One was the Parental Bill of Rights, which basically took the existing Parental Bill of Rights and the public health laws and took out all the parts that said, as approved by law, as approved by the legislature, as whatever, all the exceptions to the rights. And rights are absolute. Despite what they're saying in Washington right now on our gun owner rights, those rights are absolute, but they're absolute within the context of the right. And I'll explain that a bit, because I want to talk about guns. But did you get a chance to take a look at that? And is the Parental Bill of Rights that you're talking about, is it different? Is it more general? How are those two different? I'm curious.
I did not get to see the one that you drafted, so I couldn't compare. I couldn't compare the two, but I'm definitely going
to
have to take a look at it now. The one now, pretty much, you know, teachers are not allowed to, you know, call your child, you know, Tom, when their real name is Sarah, without you as a parent knowing about it. They aren't allowed to, you know, teach them things without your knowledge or okay on it. You know, it's just so many of these things, which it should be common sense that you should inform a parent that their child wants to be called Tom instead of Sarah, but they don't do that. And it's absolutely nuts. The government has taken way too much control over our children via the public school systems. I'm a product of public schools, so I don't discredit them anyway. I think they are a resource that, you know, children need, but I don't think that using them to teach sexuality, LGBT, or any of those things has any place in the classrooms. Those are for the parents, and that's what that Parents' Bill of Rights bill teaches. You know, I think school choice is going to be a big issue, or should start to be more of an issue for parents. You know,
I want to just interrupt here for a bit, because I got a lot of issues to cover, and I really want to do as many of these as we can. In terms of education, I would like to move to a full privatized system, a full voucher system, where either education taxes, you know, go to vouchers for lower income tax credits, tax deductions, some kind of a system like that, or just not take the tax in the first place and put it on a full voucher tax credit system. You know, for education. And that would include all kinds of different things for education, you know, like my flying lessons when I was a kid, you know, and that kind of stuff. So is the problem, I think the problem is so bad that no government system is going to work. I don't know if you've thought about this, but could you imagine for Florida, or, you know, we're going to at the county level here, but could you imagine if Florida were the first state that had a fully privatized system? Now, we still take the federal money. We just put it into a voucher system and a tax credit system, you know, but what we do with it, what we want. But there is no government education. There'd be no need for school boards. There'd be no school administration. There wouldn't be any teachers unions, because there'd be nowhere to go. These would be all private schools. In fact, this is what I advocated when the schools locked down at the beginning of COVID. This is 2 years ago. I said, great, the schools are closed. Leave them closed. Sell them to private entrepreneurs, create private schools, do it now. This is your window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. Everybody laughed at me. They said, it's a stupid idea. It's like, no, it's not, you know, because it's going to be a lot harder once they come back. And of course, now they're back. But can you see a system of a fully privatized education system? What do you think?
Well, I think that the, you know, closing down all of the public schools absolutely showed that kids can still get an education without public schools. So they did expose the vulnerability there. And I will always support getting government out of the school system as much as possible, because clearly government in the school system has gotten us to where we are now. Our kids are not any smarter than they were years ago. We have major issues. And I think that putting education into a truly capitalist free market environment will really make some improvements, because parents will not be forced to send their kids anywhere they don't want to send them to. You will not be forced to keep bad teachers. If you want to let bad teachers go, they can implement their own, you know, rating system or what have you for that, and that it would truly make everything better. I think it would also affect the publishers, how they can sell their books.
Those
will also, I think, have to come down, because they can pay that price because they know that the government's going to pay for them. So that's going to have to come down, because it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, I think I don't have any children, but, you know, I still pay my property taxes, still go towards the public school systems, you know. So I think that would shift that there. You know, and
no, that's
I think
point.
That a lot of great things could happen.
Let me just hold you up there, because that's really important. That part of the plan that I came up with is that, you know, the deductions or the vouchers or whatever would go to everybody, because everybody pays those taxes. So whether you have kids or not, you know, your taxes are still taken from the government schools. I mean, I've already raised my daughter. She's an adult. But I still pay taxes, you know, that go to education expenses, and I have no control over that. And the parents who want to send their kids to private schools, they have to pay the taxes too. So they're paying double, you know, so you've got
and
parents.
And our grandparents, people who don't have, you know, even kids, or, you know, they're on a fixed income, they're still paying those property taxes.
Yeah, it's crazy.
To send children to school. It's crazy. And not to mention, we're paying those taxes for these schools, and then they're teaching Marxist policy. They're teaching CRT.
Yeah, exactly.
They're teaching all of these evil things. So everyone needs to really be involved. We have been involved now. Because we've seen the nonsense that's going on, but, you know, it's imperative that we don't let go. We keep this momentum and we keep making the changes.
Well, I would encourage you to think about this, and I think you will, that we could actually develop a fully privatized system. That's something I'd like to get Governor DeSantis on the show about. In fact, Governor, he was on my show back when I was on WBY. He was my last guest before that ended. But it would be great to have him. He was congressman then. But it would be great to have him back on to talk about these things. Because I think the biggest problem with conservatives in general is a lack of ideas. You know, it's always defensive. Mm-hmm. We're always like, well, we got to fight against the gun control bill. But I've got a bill that has tax credits and tax incentives, especially for low-income people and minorities, to be able to exercise their full Second Amendment rights by making gun and ammo purchases that's tax deductible or get you a tax credit for it. No one's talking about anything like that. Why not? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So let me tell you about my gun bills. We have a few here at Action Radio. And so actually Anthony Nunez, you know, you got the same last name, wrote a bunch of them. He's probably got his PhD. He was doing electrical engineering. But one of them is that's the first one I mentioned, to increase the exercise and enjoyment of the Second Amendment, is a bill that does just that. In other words, it's financial incentives so that low-income people don't lose their rights just because of the low income to their Second Amendment. The other one is changing the background check. And I don't know if we can do this on the state or whether it has to be done at the federal level. Maybe it can be done at the state level. But my idea is that instead of everybody going through a federal check What you do is you present your driver's license with your picture ID or any picture, government picture ID, at the gun retail, the place you're purchasing a gun, and they compare it against the prohibited list. And if you're not on the prohibited list, you get to buy your gun. It's up to the government to maintain that prohibited list and the stores to have a secure list, secure people that can actually view it. But if you do that, you're still doing a background check, you know, because if you're not on the prohibited list, you know, you buy a gun, but there's no registration of what you're buying. Because I believe these background checks are registering gun owners and all these different things that when you record the serial numbers and things like that, it's a gun registration scheme. And then we know what that leads to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
How's that for
you? Yeah. No, you can't legislate, you know, you can't combine a bunch of different gun laws and expect, you know, criminals not to still get a hold of, you know, guns and do the things that they want to do. You can't legislate morality, you know, we have people, you know, the law-abiding citizens who are doing these things, you know, and people are trying to take, you know, Democrats are trying to take away the rights. But sadly, also, we have some Republicans that supported red flag laws so that people have their Second Amendment rights taken away without due process. Mm-hmm. And it's a tragedy because why on earth would we allow anyone that works with the government to decide who is and who is not mentally capable of having a weapon? And, you know, a lot of veterans would be would not want to get help for PTSD because that would be on their record, and then they could have their gun rights taken away for trying to get help with their mental health, but now they could be at risk to society or be deemed at risk to society for that. And so it's there's a lot of nonsense and a lot of issues there. It's shall not be infringed. I'm supporting constitutional carry along with the governor. If it doesn't happen before I get there, I plan on sponsoring that. And full constitutional carry, all rights, gun rights, shall not be infringed.
Yeah, how do you – I'm absolutely for you on that. In fact, I got a couple of folks that might be able to help you on our Fridays. We have Jim Dykes, who's a director of Florida Carry, and we have Shirley Watchell, who's the Florida chair of the D.C. Project, which is a women and guns organization across the country. And so are the gun groups supporting you? Have you contacted them? Especially on things like constitutional carry, Florida Carry would be really big on that. But are they working with you? Have they endorsed you? Got some support from them? What's happening?
I do not have any official endorsements, but I have become acquainted with Florida Gun Rights and the Gun Owners of America, which I believe have been doing great things with advocating and actually being activists for Second Amendment rights here in the state of Florida. They have been very aware of, they've done a great job in making sure that legislators who say that they support Second Amendment are actually being held accountable. We had some, you know, there were some some gun bills that were dead on arrival during some legislative sessions, and those legislators were called out publicly for that. And I think that for anyone that wants to lobby legislators, we have to change the way that we've been doing it before, because they tell you one thing behind closed doors, or they tell you one thing during a non-election year and a completely separate thing when they want your vote. So we really have to hold them to the fire. Public, you can ask them to, you know, make a public statement on their social media, record a video. You can ask them to sign a petition, or ask them to actually commit to, you know, sponsoring or co-sponsoring a bill and get it in some writing, picture, public statement, to where you can hold them accountable if they go back on that. Because, you know, so many people are tired of conservatives saying, you know, they campaign that they love their guns, they love them, and then they won't allow constitutional carry to be heard during legislative session.
Yeah, in fact, we see this all the time. We've talked about this all the time, that Florida, the state that brought in concealed carry long before most other states, has failed miserably to bring about constitutional carry. And the reason it's called constitutional carry is it's the only legal form of law there is when it comes to guns. Now, how do you defend against that? Like, why don't you have more gun questions? I want to cover the rest of your website. We've got support, Florida First Agenda, pass an anti-abortion heartbeat bill, restore American values in the classroom, and uphold the Constitution. We've sort of touched on some of those already. But when a leftist reporter comes up to you and says, well, we have to do something. We can't have any more of these school shootings. You know, the Second Amendment isn't absolute. You know, these are just reasonable restrictions. You know, what do you say to those people?
I say we need to get rid of gun-free zones because if you're not going to have, you know, someone coming to attack a school, if teachers are allowed to protect themselves or security guards are actually, you know, well, we won't go to security guards, but I think we have to stop, you know, the gun-free zones and allow parents, teachers, whomever, to be able to protect themselves and arm themselves, what I think the solution is, because you have plenty of law-abiding gun owners who are not committing mass shootings.
Millions. Millions. Literally millions of
millions.
Law-abiding gun owners do anything every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which gets back to my question. This is another way to make the kids safer, if you want to make the kids safer, is to eliminate the government schools, because you don't see this happening in private schools. You don't see private school students coming back to their private schools and killing the new students. And if it does happen, it's extremely rare. I mean, these things are rare anyway, which is good. But I think there's something inherent in a government school system that combines everything else. You know, the young men, the fatherlessness, the social welfare. You know, breakup of the family. I hate the word nuclear family. It sounds evil. I think it was that had to be invented by a leftist. We need another name. We should call it the natural family or something like that. It'd be much. Much friendlier term, but you know these. But this, let me give you an argument that I use, and if this makes sense to you, feel free to use it as well. The way I explain this to people is that all rights are absolute. Rights are also absolute within the context of the right. So if you look at the Second Amendment, it says very clearly that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In modern language, the right of the people to own and carry firearms can't be touched. Okay, so the Second Amendment covers owning and covers carrying. It does not cover use. The use of firearms is covered by statutory law. And it has to be because all rights are absolute. Therefore, if you had a right to use, you'd be able to use your firearm absolutely. And that's absurd. That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
So the Second Amendment says that you have an absolute right that cannot be touched to own and carry firearms. Now, once you make the decision to use a firearm, now you're into statutory law, which is a lower standard, which is under subordinate to the Constitution. So the constitutional right is supreme. Absolutely. Okay.
Absolutely.
Of the right. But the right covers owning and carrying. Now, uses, there are legal uses, target shooting, self-defense, collecting, gunsmithing, you know, purchasing, artwork, whatever, you know, competitions, hunting, all these things are legal uses of firearms. There are illegal uses of firearms, brandishing, murder, extortion, carjacking, you know, mass public shooting, things like that. So there's an obvious difference between legal and illegal uses. What this means is that statutory law, the illegal uses don't touch the constitutional right because the right is completely separate. There is a complete separation from the right to own and carry and the statutory provisions of legal uses and illegal uses of firearms. So the idea of making a statutory law of gun control is automatically unconstitutional because it automatically is subordinate to the Constitution, the Second Amendment, which is an absolute right to own and carry. Make sense?
Absolutely.
So that's how I do it. Well, separate the use of firearms from the absolute right to own and carry, and you've got a totally different argument because now you can defend it, and now you can say that, well, you can't have gun control laws that touch the right to own and carry because that's separate from use. What you really want to do is regulate the use, and that's absolutely permissible in law. That's why we elect representatives, to separate legal from illegal uses of firearms. There you go. What do you think?
Listen
to the podcast.
How do you legislate? Legal and illegal? So, you know, the founding fathers said shall not be infringed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every law-abiding citizen has a right to protect themselves and their families. You know, when you're allowed to shoot someone if they're, you know, robbing you or if they're attacking you, if it's self-defense. So I don't know what other ways you're talking about making gun use illegal and legal.
No, I'm saying gun control
laws.
No, I'm not saying about making new gun laws about what's illegal. What I'm saying is that gun control laws, prima facie, the idea of making a gun control law that governs owning and carrying is impossible because it's already unconstitutional. The only laws that can be made, statutory laws that can be made, are those governing use and governing use, the illegal or the legal use of firearms. That's it. So what the left does is they blur that line. They say that the use of firearms is also included in the Second Amendment when clearly it's not. And once you make that distinction, so once you make the distinction that the use of firearms is outside the Second Amendment, there's no relationship. There's actually a wall of separation, you know, like church and state, they say. But there's a wall of separation between statutory law and the Constitution. Therefore, you can't make a gun control law. The Second Amendment doesn't affect laws governing use and legal and illegal use of firearms because they're totally separate. That's
it's all an attempt to it's all an attempt to disarm the, you know, society. And, interesting point is that we have, you know, our police officers were being, you know, attacked and, you know, saying they had discriminatory policies, that they were, you know, being racially motivated in who they decide to use their firearms on. And at the same time, Democrats are also trying to disarm the people that would be able to defend themselves if that were actually the case. So take all the guns away from society, from people, law-abiding citizens, so that only government has the use and capability of having firearms. That is the goal, 100%. That is the aim. You know,
I call that the Second Amendment in reverse.
You know? Exactly. What the goal is.
It'd be interesting if gun-free zones carried a liability clause. So if people insist on making one, fine, then you're going to cover the cost of anything that happens in there. I mean, that's just, maybe not. I mean, that's getting off the track. We don't need those laws. Gun-free zones are what I call victim disarmament zones. Tell me about, let's change around things. Yeah, thank you. Let's change things around a little bit. Tell me about support of Florida First Agenda. What's that?
So that means that anytime, you know, Joe Biden or any of his followers in D.C. Want Florida to, you know, subject themselves to, you know, to things that we don't have to, you know, abide by, be it, you know, when, you know, DeSantis called back in our National Guard, when Joe Biden wanted to use the National Guards to, you know, surround himself in his barricade and use the National Guard in a way that,
you know. Well, he's a coup leader, you know. All dictators
exactly.
are paranoid.
Exactly.
Okay.
Did not need to be used, but really to make sure that the budget in Florida, taxpayer dollars that are here in Florida, stay in Florida to help our economy, to help our people, you know, our citizens that come here and make sure that our, you know, our money is not being used, or the taxpayer dollars, I shouldn't say our money, taxpayer dollars are not being, you know, used to support things that we don't believe in, and they're not being mismanaged. There's plenty of people here in the state of Florida that need help, and the taxpayer dollars should be used to take care of Florida first before we send money anywhere else or use our programs anywhere else. Taxpayers in Florida come first.
I love it. I'm curious how far you're going to go with it, though. What would you recommend for the state? Withholding money?
You know,
getting rid of federal offices in the state? How far do you want to take it?
Absolutely. I would support an audit of actually looking at some of the government programs here in the state of Florida that actually have no effectiveness or any use. You know, government has continued to grow year over year over year, even though conservatives and Republicans say that they're for limited government, but that's the one thing that just seems to get bigger and bigger, and it costs more and more. It's not the money that's going in that's the problem. It's the money that's going out that's the problem. So I would really be curious to see how much money going out is actually going to things that we just are we don't need anymore. We just have no use for them, and we could get rid of it. But it's really hard. What is it? There's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm all for it. I mean, the states are sovereign. The states are actually like countries.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and so mm-hmm. looked at it that way. The states authorized the federal government to exist. There is no federal government
exactly.
without state permission. And so, you
exactly.
know, Pianki is one of my favorite calls. I'm surprised Pianki hasn't called, quite honestly, because he's all over this every day. Anybody wants to call 215-383-3832, the reason I don't give the number all the time is it's sitting right in front of you on your broadcast page. Not you, Emily. I mean, the folks listening. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the podcast listeners can't call in. So you guys need to listen live. All right. Here's something a little different. I have a constitutional amendment that I wrote. It says Congress shall not have the power to borrow money. Very simple, very straightforward, but incredibly powerful. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution shall be amended by striking Clause 2 to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Section 8, Clause 1 shall be amended by adding at the end, and Congress shall have no power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, nor to print money to cover expenses greater than revenues. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me. I think
so. This has got to come from states.
Yep,
exactly. Congress is never going to pass that.
Yep.
Yeah. What do you think? Go ahead.
I think that the role of government has completely been skewed, and that, you know, borrowing money, doing things of that nature, treating government like it's a business has gotten us in the situation that we're in, and we really need to get back to the fundamental principles of what the government is supposed to do, and that's to, you know, protect my rights and your rights from being violated. And we
mm-hmm.
do that via the military, the judiciary, and, you know, our first responders. And other than that, the government has no business being involved.
Yeah. What about illegal aliens? Do you think, as we've talked about here on the show, that that state boundaries are state boundaries? And when the 14th Amendment says that citizens of the United States are also citizens of the state in which they reside, which means that non-citizens of the United States are also not citizens of the state in which they reside. What can Florida do, independent of Brandon's invasion, to remove illegal aliens from our state?
Well, I think one of the things that would help or would, you know, crack down on that would be to make E-Verify, make it a requirement to use E-Verify. You have to verify, you know, that they are a legal resident and, a citizen in the state of Florida. You know, there's been people, when I'm out, you know, talking to voters that
mm-hmm.
want a border on Florida. They want to make sure, you know, that we don't have illegal aliens coming in here. In Jacksonville, Florida specifically, we had flights of illegal aliens coming in that we didn't even know about. And we had
can you
no
stop
notice.
Those? Can you tell the tower not to clear those airplanes? You know, can you have the state National Guard there? I mean, what can you really do? I mean, there's some options here, I think. How would you stop those?
There are, and I don't know what all of those, I haven't explored all of those or what really
okay.
came of that when it was here, so I can't answer that. I imagine that the FAA or somebody would have to let us know, you know, the flight logs, where they're coming from, what the purpose is, I don't know what the right is.
I mean, you're a maintenance log person. I mean, I'd love to see the flight logs published at the FAA of the illegal alien flights. You know, Brandon released,
exactly.
200 illegal aliens on June 1st at 3 a.m. at Jacksonville International. You know, I mean, that would be fascinating to know. And like I say, and you don't have to have all the answers. I ask impossible questions. And a lot of them are thought questions. A lot of them take a lot of reasoning over time. So I never expect mm-hmm. anybody to have, absolute snap answers to what I say. But I do want you to think about stuff. And I think that publishing the flight logs of the illegal alien flights into Florida would be quite interesting, especially if we had like a welcoming committee of citizens there when they came in, especially if we knew they were coming in advance. Come on, everybody, let's go to the airport in the morning. Party at the airport.
Every airline has the passenger list before they take off for people who are citizens. So there's no way, how are all these, illegal aliens getting on a flight and we don't know who they are, or that they're not,
Interesting. Well, let me ask you one more question this, and then I want to talk about the anti-abortion heartbeat bill. We have a concept here. I'm trying to do it with our county commissioners. They're geldings just like the rest of the Republicans. The idea is civil asset forfeiture. So in other words, if you're in Santa Rosa County illegally, we've declared this an illegal alien-free zone. It's the opposite of a sanctuary county. And so anybody who is here illegally, they're going to have their house seized, their car seized, all their property seized, everything we can. The company that hires them, we're going to seize the company. The Catholic charity that aided and abetted illegal aliens flowing through our county, they're going to get seized. So use civil asset forfeiture, which is a local law enforcement procedure, to seize these assets. Those assets are then returned to the taxpayers at the end of the year. There's like a disbursement program. So nobody makes money off this. And being illegal aliens, you don't have to wait for conviction, trial, things like that. Just being in the country illegally is grounds for seizing, because illegal aliens have no rights by definition, because they legally can't be here. You can't have rights in a place you're not allowed to be in. I don't care what the Supreme Court says. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested in exploring this at a state level, a state civil asset forfeiture program for illegal aliens, to make it impossible for illegal aliens to live in Florida so they pack up and go somewhere else? What do you think?
My question would be, who do you put in charge? Who do you put in charge of it? And you're giving the government more power to dictate that. What do you do with the assets once you take them?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, disperse them.
Where does the money?
In other words, they go back to Florida taxpayers. It would be a disbursement program. So, like I say, nobody makes money off this. Go ahead. That's
a
good question.
How do they go back to Florida? How do they go back to Florida taxpayers? Would be
That's
my
a good question.
Question.
You could do it possibly a reduction in the sales tax. You could do this different ways. I don't know, because we don't have an income tax, which is good. I mean, you know, God bless Florida not having an income tax. At the county level, there are taxes. We could have a county like a refund them. You know, you get, or like a royalty system, like where the oil companies pay the Alaskans for drilling oil. You know, we'd have a reimbursement somehow. That's a good question. I don't know how to implement that. That'd be something – that'd be where the legislature would take over from the idea and generate something from that. But I think it's –
I don't –
go ahead.
I don't think that I would personally support that, because once you give government an inch, they take a mile. So that would –
well, they've already got this power, though. They've already got the power of civil asset forfeiture.
They do already have it, and so I would have to look at, well, what is that actually done with the power that they have doing that now?
Mm-hmm. Well, with American
and
citizens,
now you would just
they've taken without conviction.
Aid.
Yeah, with American citizens,
right.
They've taken without conviction. That's illegal, because that violates due process.
Right.
But the due process for illegal aliens is different, because they can't be here. And if they don't want to get prosecuted, pack up and go home. You know, so there's an easy way around this. Okay, anyway, no,
somebody
disagree with me. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, but they wouldn't even be able to have those assets if they didn't have a job to be able to get the money to pay for those assets, which means E-Verify would stop it, should essentially stop it before it even got to the fact where they started owning assets.
Exactly. But E-Verify, I don't know if it has the teeth that this would have. If E-Verify was combined with civil asset forfeiture, you bet it would be enforced by the companies. So I don't think there's a real penalty for it now. Maybe that's a way to start it. Start with the civil asset forfeiture for E-Verify violations of both the illegal aliens who are discovered and the companies, or you can even just do the companies that hire them. That will stop that process real fast. Make it impossible to get a job illegally. Yeah. All right. Well, I got a few minutes left, and I have to take a couple of extra minutes because of some things I haven't been able to play because we've been talking to so many people. Tell me about your abortion bill.
So I think, you know, now we've had Roe v. Wade, overturned, so the rights will go back to the states of what they want to do. There's no reason with a Republican-controlled House and Senate that we should not have already had something like this passed, or even, something stricter passed. But if it is not sponsored in the next legislative session or before I'm elected, then it would be my intent to sponsor a heartbeat bill as a segue into a just full-out abortion ban bill in the state of Florida. So, you know, taxpayers don't need to be paying for these. Life begins at conception, and it's time to stop supporting killing babies.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that, but my contention is that Roe v. Wade was never a legitimate decision, and the states never had to honor it because the Supreme Court has no, you know, constitutional authority to make policy. So they can't do what they did. So the fact that they wrote a policy, there's not a state in this country that could not have said, this decision is illegal. It is illegitimate. There is no authority. We're going to pass this law. We're going to stand by it. What's the Supreme Court going to do? This cooperation with the court for no reason, this blind faith that they, quote, interpret the Constitution, which is a bunch of BS also. How strong would you want to stand up against Supreme Court decisions that obviously violate the Constitution, like Roe v. Wade?
Well, you know, I think that I would stand behind, Governor DeSantis. And I think that any governor beforehand could have challenged Roe v. Wade. I think the one in Texas did. Well, I know they stood up to him, to the government whenever the elections were occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So I would absolutely stand up to it. It's time for, the reason why Democrats have been so successful in everything that they've done is because they do not back down. They stand their ground and they mm-hmm. continue to fight. And Republicans always think that they have to be the ones that compromise all the time. Well, I think that role needs to reverse, and we no longer need to be the ones that are always compromising. We need to stand firm in our convictions, and I would fight it. I would fight it with the governor as long as he wanted to fight it, and even beyond that.
No, I like what you stand for. I'll support you. I think this is great. That's why I wanted to get mm-hmm. you on the show to talk about these issues. I mean, there's a reason I called it there's my 90-second warning. There's a reason I called the GOP the gelding old party, because they don't. They don't fight. They're terrified of being called racist. They compromise. They wimp out. They don't have new ideas. Part of the show
exactly.
is coming up with new ideas. So if you need new ideas, come to us. Hey, I need a new idea. This Greg goes, okay, we'll see what we can do. We'll put the panel to work on it. We only have a minute left. I've got to play a couple of things, so I'm going to go over by a couple of minutes. But let's get your contact information, where you're running from, websites, Facebook pages, anything that you'd like, email addresses, anything you want to give so people can get in touch with you.
Okay. You want me to go ahead and do that now?
Yeah, do it right now. And then I have to leave you,
okay.
And then I have to go play a couple
of
things.
So
yeah.
My website is emilynunez.com. I put my personal cell phone number on all of my palm cards and materials. That's 904-403-8903. For any questions, I am running out of District 15 in the state of Florida, which covers all of Nassau County, and it covers some of the north and west side of Duval County. If you would like any information on any of those things, then please contact me there. My email is also emily@emilynunez.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on. And let's get you back on before the primary in August, at least once, maybe twice, so we can get everything covered that needs to be covered. Thank you, Emily. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care now. This is Greg Penglis, host of Action Radio. Greetings, patriots from all across the Panhandle and from the Gulf Shores of Alabama and Mississippi. In conjunction with the Escambia Federated Republican Women, the Gulf Coast Patriots is hosting a huge birthday celebration to honor President Trump. Saturday, June 11th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Ultra Mega Festival and Trump Birthday Party at the Santa Rosa County Fairgrounds, 8604 Bobby Brown Road in Milton, Florida. All conservative groups are specially invited. Bring your family and friends for fun and games, music, food, meet and greet the candidates, pony rides for the kiddies, show off your mega gear and America First swag. This is a tailgate-style event, so bring your chairs, tables, and tents. Come celebrate the birthday of the only person to be both the 45th and 46th president at the same time, our president, Donald Trump. Happy birthday, President Trump, and thank you for what you gave us. You gave us pride in our nation again. You made America First a goal that not only could be achieved, but was. Thank you for $1.85 gasoline and so much energy we could export it. Thank you for putting us on a level playing field with China. Thank you for not surrendering in Afghanistan and for trying to end the war there and everywhere we were involved. Thank you for not letting Russia invade Ukraine and North Korea for not testing nuclear missiles. Thank you for so many accomplishments when the entire Washington, D.C. deep state and the National Socialist media were against you. So let us just say now, happy birthday, Mr. President. See you all at the party, Saturday, June 11th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Santa Rosa County Fairgrounds. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. I am proud to announce a new feature of Action Radio. Santa Rosa Volunteers has commissioned me to bring to you an education in our founding documents, one focused subject at a time. Each week, we will have a new presentation drawing from the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, the Constitution, and who knows, maybe back to Magna Carta. So enjoy learning about your God-given birthright in these vignettes. Share them with your children, your grandchildren, your parents, your friends, in fact, anyone you want to serve, an accessible yet poignant introduction to a lifelong journey
in the study and practice of liberty. The whole purpose of these presentations is to inform a generation or two of Americans about the true meaning of our founding. They should have gotten that in school. Since that is not happening, Santa Rosa Volunteers has decided to help change that. If you want to learn more about Santa Rosa Volunteers and maybe get involved, their website is srv1776.com. srv1776.com. Their email is srv1776@protonmail.com. It is their goal to share local community information while encouraging everyone to feel welcomed and informed. Santa Rosa Volunteers says, "Arise, patriots! It is time to take our republic back. The sleeping giant awakens. Arise, patriots, and get involved." Until next time, this is Greg Penglis for Action Radio.